Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, April 18th, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140, participant code 385-698. If anyone would like to email us a question, you can send it to questions@nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. All right, tonight's scripture reading is going to be Proverbs chapter 8. Proverbs chapter 8. Doeth not wisdom cry, and understanding put forth her voice? She standeth in the top of the high places, by the way in the places of the paths. She crieth at the gates, at the entry of the city, at the coming in at the doors. Unto you, O man, I call, and my voice is to the Son of Man. O ye simple, understand wisdom, and ye fools, be ye of an understanding heart. Hear, for I will speak of excellent things, and the opening of my lips shall be right things. For my mouth shall speak truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. All the words of my mouth are in righteousness. There is nothing forward or perverse in them. They are all plain to him that understandeth, and right to them that find knowledge. Receive my instruction, and not silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is better than rubies, and all the things that may be desired are not to be compared to it. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and find out knowledge of witty inventions. The fear of Jehovah is to hate evil, pride and arrogance, and the evil way, and the forward mouth do I hate. Counsel is mine, and sound wisdom. I am understanding. I have strength. By me kings reign, and princes decree justice. By me princes rules, and nobles even all the judges of the earth. I love them that love me, and those that seek me early shall find me. Riches and honors are with me, yea, durable riches and righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, yea, than fine gold, and my revenue than choice silver. I lead in the way of righteousness in the midst of the paths of judgment, that I may cause those that love me to inherit substance, and I will fill their treasures. Okay, that was Proverbs chapter 8, verses 1 through 21, I believe I read. All right, tonight, just a few things. We did have a meeting last week, and I know I had some problems with my computer. I had to run down to New York City and pick up some parts, and I was down until, goodness, last night, I think it was, when I came back up, or trying to think, maybe it was, I think it was yesterday. But, yeah, yesterday evening. Anyway, and I know Gerard was stuck, so he couldn't make the meeting, but we did what we could on the meeting, really, to kind of just get things started in the way of preparing to talk with sheriffs. We're planning on calling sheriffs this week. We're going to be meeting with a group of people, a small group, early part of this week, and some retired sheriffs, maybe even some sheriffs that are existing right now, and some deputies. And some of the leadership of National Liberty Alliance, and we're going to discuss with them a plan to try to work with the president, with the sheriffs, particularly out Oregon at first, and trying to work to pull the state together, to really learn and enforce the Constitution. And what we need to do, this is now is the time for the people to step up. Now is the time for the people to be active. We can only go so far, but the people have to be seen. They have to step up. We have to organize in our states a lot better than what we've been doing, and start to work towards visiting different liberty groups within our states. You know, start off local as we grow, and people come in from other counties, they'll be running local, and before you know it, we should be talking to people throughout and bringing people in throughout the entire state. We need to build up our ranks. It's time to draw together. And also, we're starting a campaign, again, with myself being down until last night, and I know Gerard was tied up with some things last week, and others. You know, we were unable to prepare for as much as we'd like to have prepared, but we're going to do our best this week to prepare for some things for people to be doing in their states by contacting the sheriffs and making sure, particularly, that they've received our papers. So we need to work out a campaign in every state. You know, a small group or a large group of people in every state need to get together and make a plan and get all the phone numbers of all the sheriffs. We have them. Ask the national leadership, and we'll get you a copy, a list of all your sheriffs in your state with their phone numbers, their fax numbers, and even their addresses. And what we want people to do is, and again, we'll write this down before we get moving on it. Right now is the time for organizing. I think it's going to be a few days to a week at least before, maybe by the end of the week, before we're able to organize enough to maybe put something down on paper, which is kind of a dialogue for people to speak to the sheriffs about. Or you can be creative yourself. But the key thing is to make sure that they're getting our paperwork, to make sure that they're reading it, and to make sure that they, you know, realize that they need to be learning the Constitution and starting to enforce the Constitution, because only the people working with the sheriffs through enforcing the law are we going to save this nation, at least peacefully. And it shouldn't take them long to realize it if they don't realize it yet. But again, they need to see that the people within their state is supporting them, and that the people within their states is stepping up and trying to bring an education to them, bring information and understanding to them. We started working on a PowerPoint. We've written most of the presentation. We're just going through it and kind of brainstorming it, maybe adding a few things here or there and pushing things around, maybe reorganizing what we have. It's about 9 pages. We're going to try to shorten it up maybe, but I think 9 pages probably is about 40 minutes reading, 35 minutes. So what we're going to do is as soon as we know that we have what we really want, and this is directly to the sheriff, to empower the sheriff, for him to understand what his authority and what his power is, you know, and by what authority he acts. He needs to have that sense of security of the law and acting within the law. And you just have that knowledge, and knowledge is power. It you know, it gives you strength and makes you bold. And so that's what we have to give our sheriffs. Now, we've been doing this with letters. I've been educating them and inviting them to come to the National Liberty Alliance or to powerofthecountysheriff.com or .org. And to come to the site and take our free constitutional course and, of course, our civics course, and to encourage their deputies to do the same. But when we get this video done, it's going to be a PowerPoint video, and we will be putting it up on YouTube. We'll put it up on our website, and we're going to be asking the people in every state, again, to organize, to communicate with each other, to make a plan, and to methodically go through the entire state, contacting each sheriff by phone, leaving a message if you don't get them directly. Generally, you won't, but you can leave a message to make sure you're going to call back to find out, to make sure that he's been getting our information that we've been mailing to him. We'll be sending out the information, of course, on this YouTube, well, on this PowerPoint video, which we're going to be running, put on YouTube. And we want to get the sheriffs to watch this, because this, again, should be empowering to them. But again, it's the people that got to do it. If the people don't do it, it's not going to get done. It's up to everybody to get involved. It's time to wake everyone up. There are lots of people that have been watching from afar. It's time for the people to really step up. And even if they don't join in as far as becoming a member, they should definitely get involved in working on these phone calls to sheriffs and so on. So this is a major part of our plan. And once we can get the sheriffs to start enforcing laws, the Constitution, then, of course, we're going to move towards some indictments. Now, we always have the olive branch out. We have the olive branch out even to the judges. All the judges, they've got the opportunity to just do the right thing. It doesn't matter how they've been behaving up until this point. But if they start doing the right thing, you know, we'll forgive and move on, no matter what, with the exception, of course, with injured parties. At some point in the future, if an injured party steps up, and you know, for every injury, there must be a remedy. It's a common law principle. So, but again, you know, they will escape the jail cell maybe. So we don't want to, and look at, we got a lot of people who are just useful idiots. They just, it is dumb, just like we were at one point in time. And they've been taken advantage of, and they've been doing stupid things, and they've been a little greedy and doing the wrong things. But, you know, we gotta work to save the nation. We're not here for vengeance. And that includes not only just the judges, but also governors and anybody else in office. We've got to move to governors. And there are some sheriffs who probably will end up with indictments. And they're just doing the wrong thing. And we know what they're doing. But even they have the opportunity to just start doing the right thing, and we'll ignore the wrong thing. As long as they start doing the right thing now. So we're at that point. And we mentioned at the beginning of the year, you know, this is the campaign for justice, and we intend on accomplishing our goal this year. We do know that they intend on accomplishing their goal, and their goal is to close that iron fist. And so we really need to get ahead of that and prevent that from happening. And it starts, by taking back the judicial process. Bring justice into the courts, and you bring justice throughout America in every judicial and in every governmental realm in the nation, whether it's federal, state, county, city, town, village, it doesn't matter. Because if we're out there enforcing the law, and the law is the Constitution, and they're behaving and following the Constitution, well, then we've accomplished our goal. Okay, I don't know, Gerard, if you may have some things that you want to speak about before we move over to Brent. But before we do that, let me just ask, did you have anything, Gerard?
Well, nothing in particular other than to reiterate kind of what you had said, that, you know, the people got to step up. You know, we've done lots of work, lots of papers, all kinds of things, and look at, this is all going into the people's hands now, because, you know, we have to march around those jails and blow our horns, you know, and when we put that indictment in, it's going to be up to everybody to make sure that it goes in into the right place, because that's not up to us. That's up to the people. That's up to the sheriffs. And it would be nice to have them on board before that, but nevertheless, everybody knows what their job is, and, you know, we've already sent them paperwork to tell them what their job is, and so now it's up to you guys on the street to be over there policing them and saying, what are you doing? It's time to go. Look, the battle cry is out. It's time for us to stand up. You know, our paperwork are the nails, and God gave you a hammer. You need to pick up that hammer and drive in those nails. We've given you all the resources as far as the law is concerned, you know, and the Constitution, which is the law. So now the people have to take it in their hands. That's all they're going to understand is the people getting together and demanding justice and going in and just pushing it through. It's the only way it's going to work, and that requires people. It requires sheriffs, it requires law enforcement, and it requires people, and we're ready. This is it. We can't wait any longer. This is, you know, we've reached that point, and the gauntlet is coming. I hope you guys are ready, because It's not in National Liberty Alliance's hands once we release that paperwork. It's in you guys' hands. Now you got to pick up your horn and blow your horn till the walls of Jericho fall down. And for hours. And I literally mean people should, once that indictments go out, you better circle them jails and them courts and make all kinds of noise. Go out and get horns and blow horns. Refight the Battle of Jericho, because that's what it's going to take. And if that happens, guess what? We will prevail. So that's all I wanted to say. I just want to reiterate that this is really up to the people now. You know, we've put our best foot forward. We know that what we have is pristine. It's lawful. It's legal. It's right there. It's founding father. You can't ask for any better research. You can't ask for any better writing. This is it. This is the paper that you can pick up, you can live and die for. That's what you need. The people need leadership. Well, guess what? You got it. You got those. Look, at the Constitution is just a piece of paper until you pick it up and you fight for it. So that's what we're going to do in the next coming weeks and months. We're going to be marching into a figurative battle, but it is a literal battle. It really is. This is it. We're going to fight this battle, because if you don't fight this one, you're going to be fighting the one that you don't want to fight, and the one that the win is not so sure, and the blood is real. So let's get busy. Let's get our committees of safety going. Don't overthink it. It's not a complicated thing. It's a town hall meeting without the town board. You know, it's a very simple thing. Get together, you know, get in your committees, get talking about stuff. And if you got problems, you know, you have a right to assemble. And once you put it on paper and you call in and you give it to a grand jury or some other enforcement arm, a grand jury is, you know, when you do an investigation and there's criminal things pending, it needs to go to a grand jury. And then the grand jury needs to indict. And all that takes the people pushing behind it. So we're there. We're ready. And I'd like to see these in every county, in every town, in every county. That would straighten things out. You know, I know we're working on the federal end, but guess what? The federal government puts their feet down in our counties. And what do? They step on us when they put their feet down. They step on Lavoie Finnegan. They step on you. They step on me. Well, we got to start becoming cactus spurs and porcupines. And every time they step down, they got to get a quill in their foot. That's what you guys are out there. Got to hammer those nails in. Pick up the hammer and use the nails that we gave you and hammer them in. And believe me, it's coming. It's right around the corner. Look at those boys are ready. All those men and boys are ready to get out of jail. We're going to do it. They should, you know, every day that they're in there is a day that we can't sleep good. And them poor boys, my goodness, I wouldn't want to be in their shoes. You know, I'm not worthy to be in their shoes. My goodness, I don't know what I would do. Anyway, let's get it together. Let's keep together. Keep the dialogue open. Keep animated. We're all they have. They have nothing. We are all they have. Get out there. Make some noise. Make them uncomfortable, your officials that are not doing the right thing. Tell them you're going to get rid of them. Recall them. You know, get active. Turn the boob tube off and go out. Get out into your towns and your counties and your streets. Get talking. Okay, I rest.
Thank you. And, you know, look, for quite some time we've been pushed to the right or to the left, and we haven't budged either way. We've stayed on course, standing on principle, waiting for the right time to do things, and not acting too quickly or too hastily, you know, patiently moving along. And we've seen people pushing others into violent moves, and we're going to need to be real careful about that, you know, to maybe pick up guns and do something stupid. And I will say, I think we brought this up before, we're going to bring it up now, we need to bring it to light. There are people trying to move militias in a direction to do stupid things. And there are people who are trying to look like us. You know, a lot of them came from us originally. They went off on their own, thing, and they were doing strange things and when they were with us, and we asked them to stop. They refused to listen, and we had to cut them off, and then they went off trying to do something else, and they got vengeance in really in their hearts. And they're impatient, and they're trying to seize control of the movement, of what's going on. You know, we're moving very closely to things, and people, there are people out there trying to really cut it off, and they're trying to move the militia to do stupid things. And I want to tell you, the militia, you can't do anything stupid. You can't go out and arrest anyone. You can't put a gun in anyone's face. That's outright wrong. It's evil. Let them do that, and we need to just defend ourselves. That's okay to defend yourselves, but don't be the one to be doing those things. And, you know, some people think that they're going to be able to go out and arrest people. You know, where are they going to put them? In the basement of Denny's or something? You know, it's just stupid. So hopefully they'll come to their senses and realize, and I think they will. Of course, the people behind this push, I don't know whether they'll ever come to their senses, but we can pray for them, and hopefully they will too. But if the militia just does the right thing and doesn't do anything stupid, then they're not going to make any headways anywhere. And we, you know, methodically, in under principle, little by little, we will take back the courts and the judicial process and bring it back under the Constitution, all of these elected individuals. Okay, so let's see. Before we move on to our guest tonight is Brent Winters, but before we go to him, I don't know, is Gary here or anybody else that's been receiving any mail? Do we have any questions? Any mail coming in with any questions? Okay, I'll take that as probable no. Okay. All right, well, we're going to move over and we're going to hand the mic over to Brent Winters. He's the author of Excellence in Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. That's commonlawyer.com. And tonight's topic, I believe, is going to be on the county sheriff. Brent, are you with us?
I'm with you. Mic.
Okay, you got the mic, Brent.
Thanks. Thank you, and thank you for allowing me to talk. I think I'd burst if I couldn't once in a while. It's time for planting here in the Wabash Valley, and in the midst of all the madness that swirls about us, I'm reminded again that God makes all things in nature go according to plan. Spring comes every year, sun comes up every morning, it's planting season. And no matter what else happens, he's in charge. And I believe, if I read history correctly, and I've seen it in history over and over again, the lawless crowd will play with matches in a dry timber till they start a fire. That happened during the Reformation in Europe, and it's happened many times since. And I believe it will happen this time. I believe that what the lawless crowd will do, the feel-good lawless crowd, they'll strike the matches that will incite a change. But it's up to the lawful crowd, the crowd that believes that the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God should prevail, it's up to them to have something to offer when that time comes, because a fire destroys everything, burns everything up. And that's what I see the lawless crowd trying to do. But if there's something in place, something offered that's right, namely lawfulness, then everything will work out good, as it did in our war for separation from the British Empire. It wasn't properly a revolution. The law of the land, our law of the land, Article 6 of our Constitution, our common law, does not seek to avenge the past. The law of the city and its revolutions always seeks to avenge the past. Our country did not start because we were avenging past wrongs, as occurred in the revolution in Russia in 1917, the revolution in France, just after our American separation from Britain. Those were wars to avenge the past, and they slaughtered not hundreds of thousands, but all added up together, millions of people. And then they did away with the calendar. They did away with the memory. They did away with the books that told history. And they said, we're starting afresh. We want to avenge the past. And we didn't do that. As a matter of fact, we just continued here in America, as we always had before, the same courts, the same colonial legislatures became state legislatures. We didn't avenge anything. We kept what was good and said, we want to keep doing what is good, and you fellows aren't allowing us to do that. And that was the problem. But we have just two volumes, The Laws of Nature, unwritten in creation, in the nature of things, and The Laws of Nature's God, written particularly and precisely in our Bibles. We take that from our Declaration of 76. Declaration of 76 took that from William Blackstone of about 10 years earlier, and he took it from the common consensus of his countrymen in England, our common law. We're talking about the sheriff. The sheriff. The sheriff's a common law office. Someone has said, and people are asking, according to the conversations I've had with John, people are asking, where is the word sheriff in the Constitution? If you're going to ask sheriffs to abide by the Constitution and say they're bound by the Constitution, where is the word sheriff in the Constitution? Well, I'd ask, where are the words a fellow's innocent until he's proven guilty? Where are those words in the Constitution? Indeed, they're not there. Where is the word marriage in the Constitution between a man and a woman? It's not there. But both of those, our Supreme Court has said our Constitution upholds as a fundamental right, innocent until proven guilty, the right to marry. Where are the words separation of powers in the Constitution? They're not there. But it's common law doctrine, and it oozes out of every phrase of our Constitution. All legislative power, it says, is in the Congress of the United States, Article 3, the first phrase. All executive power is in the President of the United States, or I said Article 3. Legislative power, Article 1. Executive power, Article 2. Judicial power, all judicial power at the national level in the general government. All judicial power is in the Supreme Court of the United States, a creature of our Constitution. Well, that's separation of powers, but the word separation of powers isn't there. How about the words invidious discrimination? Our Supreme Court has recognized that invidious discrimination, that means discrimination that incites envy, is unconstitutional. It's not in the Constitution. How about the words telling us that 5 of 9 Supreme Court justices established the rule of law in America? Where's that in the Constitution? I'm telling you, it's not there. Not at all. Not at all does our Constitution say that a majority of justices must prevail and the rest of the courts must follow them. The word stare decisis, let the decision stand, that we are bound in our common law country, our courts are bound by the decisions of the Supreme Court of the United States. Where's that in our Constitution? It's not there. How about the word co-equal branches of government? Are the branches of government, the three branches, executive, legislative, and judicial, are those co-equal according to our Constitution? You bet they are. Neither one of them trumps the other. Well, the words co-equal, though, are not in our Constitution. The word substantive due process is not in our Constitution. Is there such a thing? You bet there is. And it's unconstitutional, a violation of due process, where the ends of following a particular procedure produce a result opposite to our Constitution. That's a violation of substantive due process. And I'm just touching a few. There are a lot of words, including the word sheriff, not in our Constitution. But that does not mean that that a sheriff is not bound by our Constitution. Why do I say that? Well, there's not an office in the government of the United States, there's not an office in the state governments, not an office holder in those offices that's not bound by our Constitution. Why would a sheriff think, because the word sheriff's not in the Constitution, he's not bound by it? No, the Constitution says everyone who is an agent or otherwise employee of government is bound by the limitations of our Constitution, and there are different ways that happens. But beyond that, that you don't have to have the word sheriff. There are a couple of states in our union don't even have sheriffs. Alaska is one of them. There's another one on the East Coast. But every employee of government, every agent, everyone acting in concert with government, even if they're not paid, is bound by the limitations of our Constitution. But beyond that, the office of sheriff, more than many offices in government, we got a lot of weird offices in government these days, and czars are multiplying like rats, and many other bureaucratic offices are too, but every one of those peoples is governed by our Constitution, controlled by it, limited by it, and it is the sheriff who is bound by it, bound, duty-bound, duty-bound to ensure that all the other bureaucrats, federal and state, within his bailiwick, that means within the territorial boundaries of the county wherein he serves, he is bound, duty-bound, by our Constitution, by our law, by the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, to ensure that no one within that county, the territorial bounds of it, is denied due process of law, and that every person is unmolested in that way. But beyond that, as I'd said, sheriff is part of our common law. That particular word's there. If anybody is referenced, that word sheriff is part of our common law. Well, you say, but is our common law part of our Constitution? No, our common law is not a part of our Constitution. Our Constitution is a brief of common law government. Let me quote the Supreme Court of the United States. They said this: the framers of our Constitution were born and brought up in the atmosphere of the common law, and thought and spoke its vocabulary. When they came to put their conclusions of fundamental law in compact draft, he's speaking here about the Constitution. When they came to put their conclusions of fundamental law in a compact draft, they expressed themselves in the terms of the common law, confident that they could be shortly and easily understood. And consequently, says Chief Justice Taft of the U.S. Supreme Court, writing in an opinion, he said, the language of the Constitution cannot be interpreted safely except by reference to the common law. That's pretty clear. He's hitting the nail with his head. He's right on the money. The Supreme Court has said some good things. Justice Taft said a good thing here. He just made the point, wake up, boys and girls. He said, our Constitution is impossible to be understood without reference to the common law, and the reference that must be made is to the first principles of our common law, and sheriffs are to abide by those principles. You see, our Constitution is so brief, it says the word jury. It doesn't tell us anything about the jury. It says the word dollar, D-O-L-L-A-R. It doesn't tell us what a dollar is. It talks about the right to remain silent. It talks about freedom of petition. It talks about the right to keep and carry a loaded firearm, keep and bear arms. Doesn't really explain any of those things. Why? Because as Justice Taft said, it's all compact draft. Separation of powers isn't explained or described or closely delineated. That's not the way our common law works. Our common law says the courts will apply it case by case. We don't try to in our legislation and there was a time in the not too distant past when we didn't try to define everything and preempt everything that everybody would do and control the future through legislation. No, we were a common law country, so we waited till something happened and there was a fight, and then we didn't look forward to try to control the future with legislation prospectively. We look back retrospectively and we ask the jury what happened. The common law looks back and it says what happened. Because in our common law country, everything's lawful until the government says, or the court say, or a jury says, you did the wrong thing. Not everything. I'm exaggerating. I'm using the word in the pejorative sense. But we in America don't sit in fear and wait for the government to give us permission to move. We move. And we know we have, we haven't violated the first principles of our law as to other people. Or most, the most remarkable of the Saxon laws we may reckon, says William Blackstone, is the election of their magistrates by the people. Even that of their kings, yes. And Blackstone makes much of that, that the kings in England, in Anglo-Saxon England, were not elected, or were not hereditary, they were elected. And he says it is the most remarkable of the Saxon laws that the election of all subordinate magistrates, their military officers and heretics, listen to this, their sheriffs, their conservators of the peace, here's another one, their coroners, and their portreeves, continued till the Norman Conquest. Couldn't the Norman Conquest? That was over 1,000 years ago. That was in the year 1066 on the 14th of October. And he's talking about a time before the Normans arrived in that year. He's talking about Anglo-Saxon England, way back from the 5th century forward. He said they elected their sheriffs. And he said these continued until the Norman Conquest, the year 1066. And others, he said, for 2 centuries after the Norman Conquest. And others, he continues, remain to this day. Well, he wrote that in the year, or he actually lectured it, but it was recorded and published in the year 1765. Well, some of these remain to this day in America. Sheriffs and coroners, two of them he mentions here, conservators of the peace, they remain in our common law country. And we, like the Anglo-Saxons and the Danes in ancient England, before the Norman Conquest, we elect our sheriffs. In England, after the Norman Conquest, the crown appointed them. Big difference. Makes a real big difference. And sheriffs are an important place to start, in my humble, studied opinion, when it comes to reestablishing what is right in America. You know, America, the nature of the American system, as some scholars of the past have observed, is a tradition of county government, not a tradition even of state government. The sovereignty of the states is important, but that's not really where it's at and never was. The nature of the American system was the county government. You know, even the county where the president of the Confederacy lived when the war between the northern and southern states began, Jefferson Davis was from a county in northern Mississippi, and that county where he was from voted to not secede from the Union. They didn't want to leave the Union. Counties in West Virginia, or in Virginia, became West Virginia because they said they didn't want to leave the Union either. It was a county by county decision all over the country, and it caused a lot of trouble. Not every county in the South said we want to leave the Union. I live near a place out in California. California became a state before that, and there's a town out there called Rough and Ready. It's up in the mountains. Rough and Ready, and it was an old mining camp. They voted to leave the Union, and the rest of California voted to stay, and that caused a lot of problems. But even though that caused problems, that's the nature of our tradition, and our freedom depends upon that local control, that local decision making. Old Tip O'Neill said it right. He said a lot of things wrong. Former Speaker of the House, for those younger folk that may be listening, not that long ago, 20 years or better. Tip O'Neill was famous for saying all politics is local. He was an old Irishman from the East Coast, an Irish politician. All politics is local. Well, I agree with him about that, and I go on to say that all government is local, and the more local, the more real it is, and the more it's God's government, and the more lawful it is, and his eyes. Well, I want to tell you a quick story about a telephone call I got here recently from a fellow who had purchased my book on the four militia clauses. The name of the book is The Militia of the Several States. The Militia of the Several States, a primer. It's not a long book of about 100 pages. But he called me. He was 67 years old. He'd spent his life as a teacher, a speech therapist teacher, in grade schools. He had started in New York City. He was from the Queens, New York, and he ended up in Colorado, and now he's milking cows up in Nebraska, amazingly. But he said, Brent, I looked at that book, and he said, I've got an idea. I said, what is it? He said, you've got that model state militia statute in the back. He said, I'm taking that statute, and I've tweaked it a little, but I'm submitting it locally here to the city council and the sheriff. And I said, well, I bet you get more, you stand a better chance with the sheriff than the city council. He said, I think I do too, but I want them both to have it. And he said, I want the sheriff to take volunteers, to empower the local people to have a stake locally in what's going on, to give them a stake in government. And he says, I know, and we'd talked about this too, that Joe, Sheriff Joe, down in Maricopa County, Arizona, has opened up the sheriff's department to people volunteering with him. And I know he's got thousands. Those folks down there have their own organization. And it is the militia. The militia is the men, 20 years old and upward, the men able-bodied to carry a weapon in battle. But the militia is much more than that. It used to be called the Ferd Fair in ancient Anglo-England. The Ferd, that's the militia, and the Fair is the militia of Goan. The Ferd Fair, a militia of Goan. Well, they did a lot of things. They carried weapons, yes, because that was necessary, but they also were skilled in a good many other things. And that's the important point about, I call it the militia because that's what the Constitution of the United States calls it. He said, I'm going to take it to my local sheriff out here in the hinterlands. You know, there's places in Nebraska where they say if you stand on top of your house and it's a clear day, you can see the edge of the world. He's out in the middle of nowhere. I said, that'd be a good place to start, out in the middle of nowhere. If you could talk a sheriff in a place like that and taking on volunteers that would volunteer to help him in case of tragedy. And the evil empire and the lawless crowd are doing all they can to bring that tragedy, as I was saying. They're playing with matches in a dry timber. And when that hits, us being a common law country, us having common law sensibilities, and we don't have them, it's time to get them, we have the answer. And we don't have to bring order. We can just keep it. We have order now. There isn't chaos in the streets that's out of control yet. Here and there, maybe, but we've seen little things happen incited by the provocateurs of the evil empire, useful idiots. We have the mindset that can maintain order, save lives, make sure folk are fed, protected, helped, medical help to find places to live in case of tragedy. We have all that. And the sheriff is the likely fella that can keep this country from falling apart locally, because it's not going to be done anyplace but locally. And we saw the debacle of the federal government coming in New Orleans. They were going to bring order. What did they do? They hurt a lot of people. They jailed a lot of people. They spent a lot of money and really did pretty much nothing but waste money. We even got way up here where I am from New Orleans, hundreds of those trailers that FEMA brought in were going to house everybody, and they ended up selling them at a fire sale. I've seen them around town here. People told me they went down there and bought them, then sold them around town. My point is the feds and the federal government way off in Washington, D.C. aren't going to hold it together. The sheriffs are. They have constitutional authority, because they're the ones that are empowered locally to ensure that all the rest of the government employees and the bureaucrats do not violate the rights of the folks that elected them to office. I recognize that many sheriffs are very young, and it takes time to learn what a man 70 years old might know. And so they need to be young to do their job. I understand that too. So they need assistance, and we should be the ones saying to the sheriffs, we can help, we have information that can give you the confidence you need to do your job. One other thing I want to mention about the sheriffs in America, well over 3,000, 3,200, 3,300 of them, I think it is, however many counties they are, minus those couple of states that don't have sheriffs, but they don't have that many counties. The other things that sheriffs must do in order to be free, to be independent-minded, to be the sheriff that the law requires them to be, to not be lackeys for wealthy bankers on the other side of the pond and on this side. If sheriffs don't want to be lackeys for those folks, that means they must be independent, just as the branches of government are to be independent, just as each juror is to be independent of mind. They must be independent, and the only way to do that, the only way to do it, is to not accept federal money. And the biggest problem among sheriffs today is that they are accepting federal money to house federal prisoners. And the excuse that they're providing a service is no excuse at all, because they're feeding the prisoners that they house, the federal prisoners, in their jails. For a small part of the money that the government gives them to house that prisoner, and pocketing the rest. And it's gotten so bad, even here in small-town America, where I'm from, that they're building new jails to have more room to house more, so they can make more money off the federal government. And they are so wholly addicted to it that they're afraid to buck the federal government. And when federal agents come into their jurisdiction and commit atrocities, murder people, as we saw in Oregon, as we saw down in Texas. You say, well, I don't agree with their religious point of view. Well, I didn't either. But God says, honor all men. He doesn't say honor just certain people. He says, honor all men. That means you don't murder them. Due process is important. The jury is important before people's lives, liberty, or property is taken. God said, I don't want to be a part of that. And the Bible says, if you or me or anybody else doesn't say something when we see those things happening, doesn't say, no, I'm no part of this. I'm not going to be a part of that, and I want the world to know. You must make, as our law says, our criminal law here in America, you must make a clean breast of what's going on. What does that mean? It's an old word. We still use it in our law. It means you must make a firm disavowal of the murder, the taking of life, liberty, and property that is going on in the name of law, under the false flag of law, under the color of law. I'm no part of it. I try to say it as often as I can. I'm no part of this. And the answer to this madness is true law. The laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. They've got these folks that do these atrocities. They're worshiping a different God. Different God. That's a different lawgiver. Different law. Different law. Different God. Well, with that, I shall rest my case for the moment, and whatever else John has, I'll stay on a little bit if he wants me to. That's enough comments for tonight, John, I think.
Okay, thank you, Brent. All right, we're going to open up the queue, *6 to get into the queue as soon as we get it opened. And if anybody has any questions for Brent, Brent will be with us for a while taking some questions. Or if they got a comment, *6 to get into the queue. And I think it tells you to hit the 1 or something after that. *6, if anybody has questions.
Hey, John? John?
Yes.
Matthew has a question. We should let him come in there first.
Okay. Well, can you find him?
Let me try. Yeah.
Once you find him, we'll take him second. We'll take the first caller here, and then we'll take Matthew second if you can find him, okay?
Okay. His last digits are 4466.
All right, so other hosts can go looking for 4666, did you say?
4466.
4466. All right, meanwhile, we'll take our first questioner. Is that Dolores from Indiana? You got the mic. Indiana? It looks like Dolores.
Tomorrow?
260. Yep, you got the mic.
Okay.
You have a question for...
Fort Wayne, Indiana. I've been going to federal court for some years and started listening to you, and I believe I'm on the verge of a breakthrough. And so I need to tell you what it's about, how it works, and get some information, perhaps some help. Anyway, I started listening to you. I filed last spring in April, and they withheld all my summonses. I would send my summonses to the sheriffs and the marshals. You told me to send it to the governor. He's the only one that responded in the affirmative. And I was advised to file a complaint against the judges in the appeals court. They have denied me on two cases. And denied the review, and I believe that now I'm on the verge of getting a breakthrough. I am doing this according to Hebrews, the 11th chapter, the first verse and the sixth verse, okay? Get my picture. I'm doing this under command. And I was advised to, by that command, to call you as well as make charges against the man that gave me the fines and the sanction. So I've also, since I've been going to Chicago, I quit sending to all the four courts in northern Indiana, I've started to send to just the sheriff, the marshal, and the FBI as well in Chicago. So what advice do you have for me? And is there somebody to go talk to those judges, or shake them up a little bit? I eventually, after I started doing this in Chicago, two marshals from Fort Wayne came, and they're playing patty cake with the judges. The judges are all shaken up because I'm putting those writs of error and the claims in the offices of the sheriffs and marshals. And so I play goody-goody for that. Anyway, they wanted me to sidestep their office and have me sent to them personally with no names and anything. So I asked the marshal, I said, how are you going to do your job and not know who you're doing, who to arrest? He doesn't answer the question. So that's about all I can tell you, unless you've got some other things that you can advise me on, or somebody to go talk to the people in Chicago, the judges, that get something stirred up.
Well, they're all working for the same people, and their paycheck comes from the same place, and they're not, the chances of them doing anything against each other, you're talking about marshals and judges, you're in their turf when you enter their courts. And unless we learn to settle our disputes among ourselves and separate ourselves as much as possible from the system, that's going to continue. But if you're in their courts, you must be careful to not give them an excuse to abuse you, because they're looking for one. I'm telling you, they're all looking at this point. And they don't want to be bothered. What they want is an easy day. They want their paycheck to keep coming, and they don't want to be hassled.
Well, just but remember, I'm under command above.
Well, I'm not questioning that. I'm just passing along that it's important that you be as harmless as a dove and as wise as a snake, as the Bible puts it, while you're doing this. And if you're under command and you have a conviction from God, then that's a religious conviction. And if it is a conviction, and it's not just a preference for you, but it's important because you're in their turf. To really understand how to deal with the evil empire, if that's what a person thinks they're dealing with, a good place to start is the book of Acts. And pay particular attention as you read through it. It's 28 chapters. Pay particular attention to the way Paul, we call him Paul the Apostle. He's not one of the 12 disciples, but he was a sent one, so he was an apostle. But pay particular attention to the way he deals with the empire of evil. It's a lesson that's ignored, and he does it often, and he's in danger, and he catalogs his danger when he writes to the Corinthians and all the terrible things that had happened to him. As it is said, when the Apostle Paul went into a city in the Roman Empire, he never asked what the hotels were like. He asked what the jails were like, because he knew that's where he'd end up before the day was over. And everywhere he went, that's what happened. But he lived through it. And he was, as he put it, he didn't say this of himself, but he was a good soldier. He was faithful, and he didn't stop. He was persistent. And it sounds like that's what you're trying to do, is be persistent, and that's an important thing. And I don't know exactly what the case is about. I can't give you advice on it, except to be calculated, be slow, and to the most sincere the most sincere way you can, follow the law in sincerity. Follow the law in sincerity and the procedures as the court sets them out.
Well, this is not the court. This is the judicial misconduct council.
Oh, I see. Well, that's important, too. And they have rules. Go to the Internet. And that's what they're there for. Go to the Internet and just kind of peruse the rules. Pardon?
I don't have Internet, so.
Oh, well, that does make it hard. Maybe you can go to a library and find an Internet where you can, if you just type in.
I don't have a car, so I have fun driving there.
Well, things are getting worse the more suggestions I make. So, if you could find somebody to get to a computer and then copy it off on paper and get it to you, it sounds like you're the kind of gal that would read it. And if you read it, then you'd know how they play their game. And you can do it according to their rules.
Restate what I'm supposed to get a copy of. Restate that.
Say again?
Restate what you said I'm supposed to get a copy of because I didn't
know. The council that deals with judicial misconduct have, I'm sure they have rules. In other words,
if you want
to submit a complaint, they tell you how they want you to submit it and who to send it to and the best way to, maybe they even have forms on the Internet that you could fill out, you see.
No, not this time.
Well, those are possibilities, but if somebody could run that information off for you, that'd be good.
Okay.
Thank you, Dolores. Appreciate
your
questions. Okay, let's see if we found Matthew. Did we find Matthew yet?
I can't find that number. I don't know if it's
can,
typed right. 4466.
But I can't. Yeah, I found him, but I can't unmute him. I keep bouncing on his mute button, and it won't unmute. Yeah.
Is he in the queue?
No.
Okay.
His number is Anthony 4466. Yeah, he's been here.
Can he hear us talk? Right
now. Try and hit *6, Matthew, if you can hear us. *6. Must be on a cell phone.
Okay.
Well, if he can't talk now, he can go to commonlawyer.com, and there's a contact page there, and the email will probably get to me that way if he has a question.
Okay, well, while you guys are trying to unmute him, let's move to the next person here. Okay, next caller is 678. Maybe you can give us your first name and your state. 678-598.
This is Eric, Georgia Eric. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Eric from Georgia?
Yes. The stare decisis, trying to understand this, I've spoken to you before, I read your book, most of it anyway. So let me explain it like this. The difference between civil law and their idea of common law or precedent or book of precedents, and the fact that common law itself is based on principles and is wholly unwritten. And you mentioned in the book, of course, how the people who practiced these customs that sat on the jury, they didn't know how to read and write. So let's say that if I go into I'm on a jury in a civil law courtroom, in any courtroom in this country, and they say that you can't, to judge this person, and they're not going to let me judge the law, they're not going to let me judge the fact anyway, but to judge a person, they're going to say, we can't bring anything from previous acts or criminal convictions. But for me as a jurist, if someone, let's say someone punched someone in the nose, and this person's in his early 50s, well, to judge him correctly, in my mind, to do so righteously on principle, I want to know if this fellow has punched anyone else in the nose before this. And if he hasn't, then I'm going to be far more lenient. If he has, then it's showing a pattern of violence. And so I want to know this. And so this seems like a really silly civil law notion. Excuse me if it doesn't seem like it ties in with my question, but you say that civil law will say that common law is just a book of precedent, but that's not the case at all in common law. However, precedent is important, and it's precedent that's righteous. So I don't understand exactly why precedent is important in common law if it's
Rod,
based
take
entirely
control of the mic and stuff for us, right?
On,
okay.
On common, yeah. Uh-huh. If it's based on custom, if I hope I ask the question.
No, I see. I think I see. I can respond. Let's put it that way. I'll respond to you. I hope I hit something that sheds more light on the idea. It becomes a mystery, and it need not be, but it, like a lot of things, if people are unfamiliar with something, it looks hard. But once you understand it, it's easy. And even automatic transmissions are that way. I found that out when I was a kid. I thought it was hard until I said, oh, I understand how this works now, and I had it laying out on a piece of cardboard. Well, the same thing's true with stare decisis, big fancy word. All it means is that courts follow the precedent of previous courts above them, appellate courts. And that's important for this reason. On cases with like facts. That's important for this reason. All of the world is under some form of the Roman Code, and there are only about three or four forms. And in those countries, all of them, except common law countries, of which there are about five, but in all of the world, it is against the law for judges to even consider what happened in a previous case. Judges are required not by law or not by something written. It's their tradition, and it's a big one. It's the biggest part of their tradition in France and South America and Vietnam and Russia and all the communist countries all over the world. The biggest part of their tradition is that judges are to repair only to the language of the code. And the code is so written and added to and so minute, like our IRS code and regulations, 10,000 pages, that they know, oh, there's got to be something that fits exactly that we can apply here. But a lot of times there isn't, no matter how comprehensive a code is. That's what they do. They're not allowed to look at previous decisions. But our common law, anciently and even yet today, their statutes weren't a big part of Anglo-Saxon England. They didn't have a parliament. They had a witan, gwemot. That means a coming together of old bearded men, the gray heads. Witten means white, white-headed, white-bearded. And the word translated elders in the Hebrew Old Testament, same kind of idea. It means a guy with a white beard. Those fellows met, but they didn't legislate. They judged cases in hindsight. And if there wasn't a problem, as we say today, there's not a problem until there's a problem. Well, in those days, they waited till there was a problem between two fellows. They'd bring their problem to them, and the jury, the thing, as they called it, the Witten Gamot, would decide, and they would decide based upon the law talker. And the law talker is what they called him. He was the fellow, none of them could read and write, so he was the fellow that knew the law. And he'd say, well, in previous cases, when I was a young man, or when I was 40, or I remember this happened, and we did it this way. It was a situation like this, where a man stole a shoat, to hog. And same thing, how do we judge a case like that? And they had precedent. Well, that developed until we got writing. English went into writing about the year 900, 800, between 800 and 900 AD. King Alfred the Great and his Welsh scribe Asher, who knew Latin, took the Latin letters, made English. We begin to record. You said the common law is not, it's a custom, law of custom, and that was true. But now we record, we call it recording the decisions. And the decisions became recorded all over England, for example, under Edward I. He started doing that, and then we started calling them courts of record instead of just following what we remembered from custom. So now we have courts of record, and we have hundreds and thousands of cases we can consult and say, well, how did they, this is a thorny problem. I don't know what to do. A judge may say, how can I handle that? And the lawyers bring in cases and say, well, here's the way they handled it in 1946, and here's the way they handled it in 1993, and here's the way they handled it. It was on facts similar to this case, judge. Here's how they did it. And here's what the Supreme Court said in a case like that. And we, by unwritten custom, it's not in our Constitution anywhere. We follow previous decisions, and that is, we call that in our common law country, the pole star of our common law. It's not just really a part, it is the pole star. It's the big thing around which all of our common law tradition orbits, the laws of nature. That we believe, as the Englishman used to say, we don't say it in America this way, but they said, we believe in the wisdom of our ancestors. Well, we believe in the wisdom of our forebears, whether they be across the pond in England. When I was in law school, we read English cases from the 1800s and the 1700s because, and even yet today, English cases are cited in our American courts. Going way back before America, we cite English cases. Why? Because that's part of our common law tradition. I remember reading a case from Australia when I was in law school, about a fellow that was, before they had electric arc welders, he was out on a barge welding with an acetylene torch and started a fire accidentally. It was a maritime kind of a case, but then they got mixed up with burning buildings on the land. It was a thorny case. Well, because it was thorny, the judges wrestled and wrestled and wrestled with it. And they all gave their opinions, and they came up with some good ideas about how a case like that ought to be decided. And we still quote language of those old cases from the 1920s. One of the famous cases I remember is the emergency begets the man. A kid fell off a railroad bridge back in the 1920s in the state of New York. And his friend went down to get him, and on his way down he fell and was injured badly too. And the question was, is the railroad liable for both injuries? And the court there in New York, they call it the They got it the other way around. The Supreme Court is the trial court in New York, and then the appellate court is the what we call the Supreme Court in other states. But the judge in that case said the emergency begets the man, and the railroad has to, that we charge them with that knowledge, that if they create a situation where something is dangerous and somebody gets hurt, they've got to assume somebody's going to try to rescue them, and when they try to rescue them, they're going to get hurt too. So they held the railroad liable. The emergency begets the man. Those are memorable things. And judges in appellate cases that are really good at what they do, they try to use language that is memorable. And there are memorable phrases that we remember from cases, old cases, that we still use to encapsulate the first principle of our common law is bespoken in that case. So stare decisis, we call it. I wish we need an English phrase, just precedent. That's not even English either. That's another Latin root. But we follow the decisions of previous judges in cases of like fact. We say at common law, this case walks on all fours. That means it's just like this other case, or almost just like it. It can't be just like it. It'd be the same case. It's almost like it. It is, as we say, analogous. Analogous. And it's important that we do that, because if we don't do that, that's the prerogative of the courts. If we don't do that, that puts the legislature in charge. And I'll tell you what the legislature will do, and they'll do it along with the executive branch, and they're doing it now. America is the most legislated, regulated country in the entire world. Yes, even more than the communist countries. But because we still have those common law first principles, remember, the common law is not a list of laws. It's a way of life, a way of thinking. It's how we do things. It is due process. We focus on the course of process in America. God help us if we ever focus, like the rest of the world, on achieving a certain result. You know, people that say, I want justice. I want justice. God says he'll give you justice. You know that thing that people say, Martin Luther King quoted when he was in front of the monument there in Washington, D.C., very famous words. He quoted the prophet Amos from the Bible, justice shall roll down like mighty waters, said Martin Luther King. And people quote that and say, how wonderful that all is. No, that's not wonderful. Amos was talking about judgment coming down on people. That's not what he was talking about, I don't think. He wanted things to be righted. He wanted things to be done right in the future. Amos was talking about what God's going to do to people because they've done the wrong thing. We don't want to focus on justice. No. We want to focus on the course of due process. And God says you're not able. It's not your jurisdiction to focus on justice. You're not God. You don't have the power nor the authority to relegate people to hell. Jesus Christ said that to his disciples when they got a little uppity. They said, you want us to call thunder and lightning and hell down on these people? He said, no, you don't. That's not your job. That's my job. That's the job that's delegated to me from God the Father. Your job is to follow the course of due process. And if you will but do that, the result is inevitable and it will be just. We say it our common law. We still say, I still hear it said once in a while, good process, good result. Bad process, bad result. In other words, no justice at all. Do it stare decisis, following precedent of the courts, takes the power away from the legislature, and the power is ever given to a single will, whether it be one man or a combination of men called a legislative body like Congress. If all the power goes there and is combined in a single will, we live under tyranny. The independence of the courts is the foundation of separation of powers. It's the most important part. And I know judges are crazy. I know at this point the judges on the courts are, they're just words. I don't know the words to say. But I know this. I don't want power concentrated in any branch of government. And there is no branch of government that trumps the other. It's all co-equal. And therein lies the genius. That's common law, by the way. That's a common law doctrine of due process, substantive due process. That branches of government are co-equal. No, the Supreme Court doesn't have the final word on anything. That was a lie promoted by a fellow, a Quaker named Charles Beard, back about the year 1910. He became very popular. The Supreme Court quotes him still. He wrote a book called, well, what was the name of the book? I don't remember. You can still buy it. But it was about the power of the Supreme Court of the United States to have the final word. He wrote that to promote the idea that Roosevelt wanted promoted. It's not true. It's not true. That stare decisis, our common law, is all those things that our Constitution doesn't explicitly mention, but it's certainly a part of our Constitution.
Justice is now, and today, in today's world, it seems to be synonymous with revenge, and that's nothing at all what God was, or what God...
Wow, can you imagine? That's a good point. If we would but focus on the... And that's what he wants us to do. It would take the revenge out of our hearts. To focus just on the process, and concentrate on the process, and be aloof. The judgment, the Bible says, is God's. How can it be God's? Well, if we just do what he tells us to do and follow due process, he'll get his result. And then it's not ours, it's his. And we're not... we got our job to do, and he's got his job to do. And we need to do our job. And vengeance belongs to God, not to us. And process is not some things. It is everything to God. And our Constitution of the United States, by the way. And due process is not everything to our common law. Due process is the totality of our common law. The phrase law of the land, Article 6 of our Constitution, is Magna Carta's phrase, lifted from Magna Carta of the year 1215. And they didn't have the word due process back then. They used the word law of the land. And no man's life, liberty, or property, says Magna Carta, can be taken from him without going through. The prepositions there aren't translated properly in most cases. Going through due process. It's a course you go through. And that's the preposition that Stephen Langton used there to show that due process is some course we get on. Northwest Ordinance of 1787 in the preamble, it says, the course of the common law. That's what's to be observed here. Well, I hope I've said something that enlightened or maybe touched upon what you were asking.
No, that's perfect. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm talked out. You go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's great. I appreciate that. But real quick, in your book, who came out with it first? Was it John Wycliffe that translated it first from Greek, or was it this fellow that? I guess it wasn't King James, but who did it first into English?
Many people translated the Bible before Wycliffe and all those fellows. I'm going back as far as the monks that lived, monks, I'd call them monks. They weren't monks. They weren't connected to Rome. They were men who lived in Northern Ireland near Armagh. They translated, and on the Isle of Iona off of the coast of Scotland, they translated large portions of the Bible into their own tongues. But we've lost most of those. The first fellow that's credited, in our memory anyway, with translating the whole Bible into English was John Wycliffe, and he did that during the 14th century. But he did not do it from the original tongues because he didn't have access to those manuscripts, so he did it from the Latin Vulgate, translated by Jerome in about 400 A.D. That was John Wycliffe, the first man to translate the Bible into English from the Latin Vulgate. But the first man to translate the Bible into English from the original tongues was William Tyndale. That was in the next century, because after the fall of Constantinople, all those manuscripts got scattered throughout Europe of the original manuscripts of the Bible. And as soon as people got a hold of them, they started trying to figure out what they were saying. That was big stuff. And amazing how God used the Turks, 180,000 of them, to destroy the last vestige of the Roman Empire. And at the same time, they stepped on the puffball, as we have around here, puffballs. We step on them, and it spreads the spores. And the spores of God's word and the manuscripts spread throughout Europe. So John Wycliffe, the flower of Oxford scholarship, he was a professor at Oxford. They threw him out for it, but he translated all the Bible into English. William Tyndale, during the days of Henry VIII, translated the Bible into English, all of it from the original manuscripts, and then Henry VIII had him murdered, and then Henry VIII took credit and passed the Bible out. And then after William Tyndale,
That was not me. Go on, please.
Then after that, the reformers who had been exiled to Switzerland in Geneva translated the Bible into English, and they called it the Geneva Bible. And that Bible's still available. You can get it. That's the only Bible that our first fathers, the Puritans, and the Pilgrims for sure, and then the Puritans would carry. They wouldn't carry the King James. The King James Bible is a government project, start to finish, and it was translated with the intent of promoting the idea of divine right of kings. It's accurate and good. It's a good translation, but it uses some subtleties to do that. The Geneva Bible, and it was King James translation, was translated to overcome the influence of the Geneva Bible, which the reformers, John Knox of Scotland and Cartwright and those fellows from England, got together in Geneva and put it together. And it's a good translation, too. That isn't the King James eclipsed it. But it's a good one.
Okay,
both of
awesome.
Them are good,
thank
by
you.
The way. Oh, yeah. Well, thanks for
calling. Yeah, okay. Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Won't take up any more time. Thank you.
Thank you, Brett. Hey, I found Matthew, but I lost him. Does anybody see him there? Let's open him up and get his question, because we've been kind of waiting for him. He was there a minute ago. We'll just wait a few minutes, Will.
Well, I see him, but I can't unmute him. When I click him, he doesn't change.
Really?
He's about two-thirds of the way down.
Let me try it if I can find him again. I don't know why I'm having such trouble finding him. I think people are coming in and out.
Right, and he moves up and down the list. Moves
up and down, right. Just bear with me a minute. I'd like to get him in.
I don't know if he tried...
You try hitting star 6?
I don't know.
Unmute?
I don't know if you can hear us, Matt. Try to hit star 6 and then 1. Oh, I don't see him. All right, I'm going to go
on. He's in the queue. He's in the queue at the bottom now.
Oh, okay, cool. Let me just get him. We've been dying here.
He's unmuted on mine.
Okay, Matt, do you hear us?
I'm wondering what's going on.
I hear John.
I hear John, too.
I don't hear Matt.
Come on, Matt. Speak to us, Matt.
Let's get your mic, Matt. What happened? He disappeared and the next guy went.
Yeah.
He's out of the queue now.
All right, I'm back, but I'm going to let you handle it. I had a situation here, so...
All right, let's find Matt again. Look at the.
Your connection is good tonight?
Seems to be. You shouldn't have said anything.
Okay, I'm going to be gone away from the mic for a little while longer.
All right. Next caller is 7688.
Hey, guys.
What's your name and your state?
This is Matt from Oregon.
Hey, Matt from Oregon. How you doing?
Hey. Go to your next caller or something. I haven't been listening in the whole time, so I don't really have any questions, and it seems like you guys have been talking about the Bible and theology a little bit and stuff, and that's not necessarily my area of expertise or my area of interest right now. But, I understand the common law, and I understand the foundation of this country and the Christian heritage and all that. But I'll be on here with a little more in-depth question, and if anybody has any questions about committees of safety and stuff like that. I heard you guys talking about the sheriff a lot earlier and whatnot. And
talked about the sheriff and the committees of safety because that's where we're at. That's where we need to be at this point. So it's very important, I believe, for everybody to get out and get the committee of safety going. And I think Matt, it a little bit. You know, that's kind of what I was hoping you could, like, clear up. You know, if anybody's got any questions about committees of safety, in as far as, you know, the nature of what you do, you know. To me, it's a meeting of doubt.
Well, this would be a good time for me to try to get rid of, since this fellow called me from Nebraska, I would encourage people to purchase my book on militia of the several states. It's a little pocket booklet of about 100 pages. It's just big enough to carry in your pocket. But I try to delineate the duties of the four groups, those four militia clauses, refer to, and get that booklet and get one for yourself, get it in the hands of other people, get it in the hands of sheriff deputies and sheriffs. So they really don't understand, not a lot, some of them do, but a lot of them don't. They live in a police state culture, and some sheriffs understand, some don't. Some deputies understand, some don't. They're taught wrongly, and then they get in that culture and it gets worse. Give them a copy of the book called Militia of the Several States. You can get it at Amazon.com. If they run out there, then you can go to commonlawyer.com and you can order it there, and they can get it to you. Militia of the Several States by Brent Allen Winters at Amazon.com or commonlawyer.com. You can just type my name in at Amazon.com. Just type in Brent Allen Winters, and I think all the books will probably come up, they tell me. The other thing that I think would be useful would be audio commentary on Magna Carta, audio commentary. And you can also get that at commonlawyer.com. Between 30 and 40 hours of audio, blow by blow, moving through Magna Carta, as the 63 chapters are in order. So Magna Carta at commonlawyer.com, audio series, and the book, The Militia of the Several States, to get in the hands of local sheriffs and state legislators.
This is Matt here with a suggestion as well. There's a book called The Minuteman by a guy named John Galvin, and in that book, it talks about the committees of safety as well. And, I think that's probably one of the best authorities on the American Revolution in context with committees of safety and militia working together.
Well, I would want I would want it to start, because people don't know the difference, generally speaking, between militia, committee of safety, and confusion of terms. Those are simple words, but committees of safety should be made up by militia members. I don't think we can distinguish them, although whatever phrases work to get this thing, it doesn't make any difference. I'm just making the point that committees of safety historically would be a subset, probably, of the militia of able-bodied men. That'd be a good place to start.
You got that a little bit backwards. The militia and the committee of safety are separate entities, and a person in the militia should not be at least a part of the executive board of the committee of safety. When they're acting in the committee of safety, they're acting outside of their capacity as a militia person. It's like being your own boss. Because if you wanted to do something, then you could get all your militia people in the community of safety and give a yes on the order to go attack something. So there, and this is in our Constitution too, it says that the military shall always be subordinate to civil authority. And that's what the COS is,
is a civil authority. The militia is a military entity.
Well, in all events, there's a lot of confusion because a good many people are saying a good many things, and it's not coming clear. And that's why I suggest we start with the language of the Constitution, the four militia clauses, a simple explanation. That's a good place to start, and to disseminate things that don't relate. There's, for example, we've got the, what is it, that act they passed in 1903 that people say helped establish the Dick Act. And it was a perversion, and it did things that the Constitution didn't give the government authority to do, but they called to the militia, and then the National Guard arose somewhat out of that. There's just constant confusion. That's why I say back to the fountain. Committees of safety certainly were part of our earlier colonial days, but our Constitution identifies the militia of the several states. That's clear to people, and sheriffs can latch hold of that with authority, and they need to. There are only four clauses, but four clauses is a lot for any particular subject in our Constitution because it's such a brief comment. So it's important that we start with that, in my humble opinion, and work forward from there.
Did I miss something?
Say again.
Did I miss something?
I don't know. Could you? I don't know. Did you hear? Were you? Could you hear what was being said?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
Yeah, I definitely do think that there is a base place to start, and you know, in my opinion, it's the fact that this country was founded by the individual people. You know, it was the only constitution and the only country in history where the constitution was made by votes of the people and by input from the people. But yeah, there is definitely a step one, a ground zero that we need to start from.
Most people start with the Constitution, and of course there's a lot, there's centuries behind it, but because we're Americans, that's where we tend to start. That's the touchstone. But from that point, we can reach back and we can reach forward. The Constitution is not the beginning. The Constitution was not anything new. The Constitution was an attempt to reestablish what England had said we can't do. But it was already here. We just put it in writing and put it firm. And we said it, whoever said it, the people that put it together in a good way. And as they say, Magna Carta, by comparison, is disjointed and written in a hurry, and for good reason, given the circumstances. Our Constitution was fashioned, and it has things in it that could be clearer, but it's a pretty good job, and there's never been a better job as a stepping stone solid for our common law. But for Americans, if you say the Constitution, their minds immediately say, yeah, that's what our law is. And then you can take that and reach back and inform the Constitution with history behind it, because it does have a history. I'd read the Supreme Court had said. And the militia is part of that, the text of our Constitution. And using that, that's what I believe would give people more confidence of authority. Using those words, people are governed by words. We all are. Sheriffs gain confidence if they think they're following the law. And the law is, the militia is the law. It's the supreme law of the land. And the way we're to deal with the militia, our Constitution lays it out in no uncertain terms. Never since ancient Israel has any people had such precise directions from law concerning their militia. The Book of Numbers in the Bible is written to divide out the martial law of the militia and how they were to function as compared to the common law, the law of the land, as we call it, and as the Bible speaks of the land law. But never since ancient Israel has any people had such a clear law, a fundamental law, concerning their militia. They had the militia of the 12 separate tribes, and they were separate, and we have, and numbered separately, and we have the militia of the several states. It's a local matter. and sheriffs are a good place to start that. Of the four militia clauses, the Second Amendment is the fourth one, and that's the one that we have fulfilled. That's the responsibility of the militia members themselves. They have kept themselves substantially armed in America. But the other three groups of the other three militia clauses, the presidents of the United States, congressmen and senators, and state legislators and governors, those three groups have abandoned the militia clauses and their responsibilities under those clauses. They have a duty also. The militia is here. You can't get rid of the militia. It's impossible. It's the people of the United States, the males, able to carry and bear arms. They're here, and they're armed, by the way.
We're not going to get rid of the militias. However, we have the Committee of Safety that is a little bit different than what the militia is doing. We need to hear more about it.
Well, no, I understand your point, and we can read the history of the committees of safety. But I'm coming back to this point about words, and the committees of safety are good, and they'll go a long ways to do the right thing. But the word militia means something in the Constitution. The words committees of safety are part of our tradition, but they're not in the Constitution for whatever reason. The drafters chose to use other words.
But we had that prior to having the Constitution, though.
Well, as I was, and I understand that it informs our Constitution. It does. I'm talking about a starting point. I'm not against committees of safety at all. My point is, the Constitution is a good starting point. The language of it there, people will be more likely to accept that. I think that's my judgment on the matter. There's nothing wrong with committees of safety. Call them what you want. But whatever works, works. If that works, I think that's a great idea. I'm just giving my opinion about what words I think would be most likely to go into people's minds and move them.
Well, I think if you're going to try to connect the two, committees of safety and the Constitution, it starts with the First Amendment, the freedom to assemble and the freedom of speech. To assemble together and to speak on things that are of interest.
You make an excellent point, and the foundation of all the rights and all of the Constitution, it's a seamless garment that way, and the most fundamental of all rights, you drive it back even further in the First Amendment, then freedom of assembly is freedom of association. Freedom of association, which is even more fundamental than that. And that's recognized as a right under a fundamental right, even though it's not explicit. But freedom of association says, then practically speaking, I can associate with who I want, and with the freedom of association comes the freedom of disassociation. I can assemble with who I want. Fundamentally, the freedom of religion is put there because people wanted to go to church and assemble in church buildings, and they wanted to associate with the God of their understanding. And all of those things go together, the freedom of assembly. And if you have freedom of assembly or freedom of association, then freedom of assembly follows. Freedom of religion follows from a freedom of association even. So all those things are important, and you can't separate them out. They're fundamental. I agree with you. But I was trying to focus today, even though all the things you're saying are important, obviously, and fundamental to what we're saying, I'm just trying to focus on sheriffs and what can sheriffs do. It'd be a good study to understand more about what that sheriff is doing that's so famous down there in Arizona, getting enlisting men to help him or to be available to help him in many different ways. And that's more palatable, too, because the sheriff's in control. The evil empire doesn't want people just running willy-nilly. That really scares them. But it scares them even more if the sheriff is on the side of the Constitution and he's doing the lawful thing, and people listen to the sheriff. I've seen it in my own little county where there's been tragedies and dangers, and sheriff, I write up a story about it. That's the way I open a book about the militia of the several states, how a group of men came to a local restaurant in a little settlement along the road and went to the restaurant there, and it scared the owners, and they locked the door, and they kicked the door in and busted the glass and cut up the wife of the owner's leg. In the meantime, he was on the phone in the back, and he called the neighbors, and the neighbors got on the party lines they had back then and pretty soon men showed up with shotguns and surrounded them. And then somebody called the sheriff. Then the sheriff showed up later. But when he showed up, Red Simpson, when he showed up, he took charge. And before it was over, they'd run him out of town, and one of them got injured pretty bad. It was a shotgun blast. Didn't kill him, but he hurt his pride quite a bit. But that group of men swore they'd come back to town to burn the place down. They never did. But that was a good example. Without any official militia, without any committees of safety, the men responded to a need. The sheriff showed up. He took charge of the situation. And there was a couple of fellows there that were a little bit unruly, and he took charge of that. And everything went smooth as silk, and they ran the thugs out of town. Nobody was arrested. They just ran them out. Well, that's the kind of thing we want to see, the practicality, if we can, of people having the confidence to know that what they're doing with regard to the militia, for example, what sheriffs are doing, is within the law.
Yeah. You said that you wrote a book on militia?
Yes.
The history of, in that book, did you include something that happened in 1892 where the militia dissolved itself, created a committee of safety, and arrested the governor?
Well, no, the book's only 100. It's a primer. It's only 100 pages long. Okay. I couldn't include all those histories in there, but all those are good stories and inform us what we should do and how we can think, and those act as precedent, too. That's a good point.
Yeah, and while you're speaking of primer, there's this guy named Joseph P. Martino. I think he was a colonel in the military, and he wrote something, a book called Resistance to Tyranny, and that's a primer also, a primer on armed insurgency, which hopefully and here's the way I look at committees of safety, the sheriff, and the court process as well, since courts right now have adopted the constitutional avoidance doctrine. The way to force the government back into the confines of the Constitution, in my opinion, is through committees of safety. And so I don't think, you know, it's always good, like you said, to focus on the process and not the... I'm not sure what you said at the end of that, but to focus on the process. And I think that's part of the process is talking to the sheriffs, but if it was put into a percentages of your effort, I think 30% should be put into educating the sheriffs and 70% should be put into community outreach to try to get the average, normal, everyday citizens because, you know, the patriots in this country, maybe there's a million of them, and there's 300 million people in this country. So we need to get a lot more people to start to feel the way that we do, to give them information so that they understand that they're being screwed just as bad as we are. And, so the way I look at it is a 70-30 type of thing. And when committees of safety start coming along parallel with the efforts of informing people of the process of the courts and informing the sheriffs, they're going to start seeing these committees of safety forming too, and the committees are asking them to do these things. And so they're going to see that group of people growing continuously, and they're going to think, all right, well, if I don't do what these people want, I'm going to be going against them. Their numbers keep growing, and so what they're doing is righteous.
Well, what's the name of the county? What's the name of the county where you live?
Washington County.
Well, I hope you can do that there. Whatever works. If that's a good, that's a good idea. I like your idea. You know, it only takes one county, and then the county you're in, maybe that's the county. It only takes one man, and that's the reason they murdered that fellow out there in Oregon, because they're afraid. The evil empire's afraid of one man. They're afraid of just a group of men, small. They're not worried about massive stuff. They don't want anything to get started. One county, if it happens in one county, it will spread.
Yeah.
Now, that's all it takes.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep the momentum going on that. And, because they created a committee of safety down in Harney, and... Yeah, I'm trying to keep the momentum going on that because it's fresh in people's minds.
But just locally, as we were saying, that's where it's at, and that's where it'll make a difference. And people's heads aren't, if they're not locally motivated, it won't happen. So I hope that things go well for you.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, they will.
Well, it's something that we are all doing at this time, so we know it's going to work, that we know that it's going to take off.
Where are you?
I'm part of the MLA.
I know, but where do you live?
I'm in Oregon, too. I'm not far from where Matthew is.
Oh, good, uh-huh.
And,
that's encouraging to hear from you fellows.
We've made the decision that we're gonna bring about committees of safety in every county in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
And so we are working on that now.
Yeah, and that's something it's really a breath of fresh air for people like me and Gary Hunt and a couple of the other guys, because this is
Gary who?
Hunt.
Hunt?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
From Outpost of Freedom.
Oh, I thought maybe I knew him, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's really a breath of fresh air for us, because when I first came into the knowledge of committees of safety, Gary he talks about it like it's hidden from us, because they don't teach it to us in schools and stuff, and so it never seemed like that we were ever going to get to this point. And now we're just keeping the momentum going and continuing on, because this is the furthest that we've gotten in the last 4 years.
Well, the cat's out of the bag now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and that's something that I'm really happy about that happened in Eastern Oregon with the occupation, but I think that they tried to work with the government a little too much. They got the Committee of Safety going, and they should have never left that place, and they should have just kept using their ability to speak out through the alternative media. And because the whole time that they were there, I never saw them on the camera say, look, you guys, we encouraged them to form the Committee of Safety in Harney County. We're encouraging you guys to start educating yourselves on that and form committees of safety as well. But, it was frustrating. I really wish I could have gone down there and talked to them and all that and tried to, I don't know. But
it was easy for them when you got the judge that's running the whole town telling them that they're terrorists and that they have no authority and all that stuff, and everybody's looking at them funny when they're coming and going to their meetings, and then he turns around and tries to start his own committee of safety. Imagine that. I don't know. He's going to protect himself from the people. The government's committee of safety. Imagine that.
I never really understood that about how he tried to create his own. But and you know, here's the thing too, is that 47% of the people of Harney County work for the government. Now imagine what it's like in the other counties. In Washington County, maybe it's 40-something percent too. So it's a really hard struggle. And the thing that you're talking about educating the sheriffs and the police on the Constitution, well, Gary Hunt wrote an article talking about the three constitutions, the one that their superior officers told them about, the one that the Supreme Court told them about, and the one that is actually the original Constitution, the law of the land. And so the Supreme Court, with their constitutional avoidance doctrine, the cops, they think that what they're doing is just, and that they're playing by the correct rules. So there's the three constitution problem, where they may think that because of what their superior officers told them is what's correct. And so when your boss tells you something, and some lowly citizen comes and tells you something that contradicts that, fuck, man, you might just want to arrest that person for speaking blasphemy. That's one reason I'm apprehensive of the cops, is because of the three constitution problems, their interpretation of it.
Well, it's up to us to really introduce them where they need to be. Look, they're elected officials, and so they're sensitive to their constituents, you know, and you'll see it when there's a lot of times they ask, hey, people are from this town. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, we're men, not turkeys, but when we do this, we're definitely, like, putting our heads in a turkey chute, but that's something that will let people see that we believe in what we're doing. We're not afraid of what we're doing. Because the people, like, you know, I don't want to talk bad about you guys sending out letters to Sonic Means, but when you actually go there in person, they're seeing that you're not afraid of them. You're willing to suffer the persecution in order to achieve this righteous goal that we've set.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Hey, I got somebody here asking who was the author of the Minuteman. I think you mentioned that, Matt, or I don't know if it was you or Brent.
The Minuteman by John Galvin.
Galvin? G-A-L-V-I-N?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, thank you.
And then there's another book called The First American Insurgents, but I've never read either of these books. Gary Hunt has based a lot of his research off of that book by John Galvin. I wouldn't necessarily say a lot of his research, but it's a helpful source. And pretty much, I mean, if you're going to, like, get skeptical of any information out there or whatever, as long as it's talking about committees of safety, how the power is in the hands of the people, and how the Committee of Safety is a civil authority, that's all good and well, even if they're talking about it happening on Mars. But, committee.org is the, in my opinion, the best place to find information on committees of safety, because there's a website called committeesofsafety.org, and that person bases all his information off of a book by a lady named Agnes Hunt called the Provincial Committees of Safety. And that's talking about after the Articles of Confederation or somewhere about that time where the national, or not national, but all 13 colonies basically got together and started the Provincial Committees of Safety. But the original Committees of Safety are from every county, every town that was around back then, like the Suffolk Resolve, a lot of it happened in Western Massachusetts. That was a really hot spot for taking back the power, because what they have the Magna Carta just like we have our Constitution. But the king, he wanted to toss that in the trash, basically, make up his own charter and force it upon them. And they really didn't want that. They wanted the rights of the Englishmen. We want the rights of the Englishmen, too, but we want the rights of Americans under our Constitution.
Right. Gotcha. Hey, can you somebody find Kelly out there? She had something to announce tonight, and I kind of skipped over her before it gets too late. I don't know what it was she wanted, but yeah, you see her anywhere out there, Kelly? Kelly Stewart?
I'll take a look. What's her phone number end in?
Hang on. Let me see if I can. I'm not sure what phone she's on here. Hang on, I'll get it for you in a second here. Not coming up.
The way that I look at militias is, and then also the way I look at committees of safety too, is it's a place for people to come. Like, the only reason that we have gangs like the Bloods, the Crips, the Latin Kings, and all these other things, MS-13 and stuff, who, I mean, depending on what gang they are, is also the skinheads, too. They draw in the blacks, the whites, the Mexicans, because they don't have anywhere else to go. They want to feel a sense of brotherhood. They want to feel a sense of belonging. And the with the absence of militia, like you said, in the different clauses or whatever, it says there that the Congress shall have the duty to set and prescribe the training for the militia, but to reserve to the states the appointment of the officers. And so, in my opinion, the committees and the militia is giving people a place to go, a place to be accepted, because just like there's something called the Resolution of the Maryland Deputies, where they talk about how our achieving our ends is only going to come about by a union of all men of all ranks and all religions, and they need to set aside forever all of their differences and their so that we can have unity. And that's something that really frustrates me about the Patriots nowadays, with the Islamophobia that they got, and the Muslims and stuff. It's like, and the Mexicans too. They don't want illegal immigrants, but one of the militia clauses says that all persons who have or who have declared their intentions to become a citizen are members of the militia. And so, a person who has declared their intentions to become a citizen, that doesn't just mean a white person of European descent. That means anybody. George Washington said that we'll take the poor and we'll take the people who need things so that we can help them. And we'll take the blind and we'll take the motherless. We'll take the widowed. And he didn't say, but only if they're of white European descent.
Well, I've got to go, but I want to make one comment before I get off. John, are you still there? I guess he is. I'll make one comment. There will be no unity in America outside of religious unity. Never has been, never will be among men. And there won't be in America, and there wasn't in the days of the American Revolution. And if there is a different God, there's a different law. And if there's a different law, there's going to be war. And that's the way it's always been, and we can't avoid that. There is no putting down our religious differences. That'll never happen. And once you put them down, then evil will control. And that's what's happened to us now. And so there has to be to have a common law, a common objective standard whereby men can resolve their differences. There will be unity where you have that. But where you have different religion, like Islam, and you have Sharia law, there's no differences going to be put down there. The Sharia law is coming in on us. The canon law is coming in on us. The Talmudic law is coming in. All sorts of law are coming in on us. And they're contrary. Those laws are contrary to the law of the land. Those are the laws of the city, the civil law. They're contrary to the law of the land. Well, I've got to get off, but I wanted to say that in case anybody wondered where I stood on that point. I believe that with all of my heart, and I'm involved in what I'm doing because of that. The differences are important. They're not to be overlooked, especially those of Sharia law. They will destroy us, and that's what they want to do, the people that follow that particular point of view. Well, I'll get off, and if you're on there and you're listening, I'll talk to you maybe later this week. But good talking to you. Thank you, folks, for the questions you've asked, and I appreciate you letting me talk.
Well, thank you, Brett. We appreciate it. We do.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to go to the next caller. Matt, I'm going to leave you open in case somebody has a specific question for you. Kelly, if you're there, dial *6. I have no idea what phone you're on, and I'm having a lot of trouble seeing this board. Half of the numbers are, like, very light, and my poor eyes don't see that good. So I'm going to pick the next question. Stay right there, Matt, in case somebody's got a question. I'll leave you open. Okay, the next caller is Jim from Rhode Island. You're unmuted. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. The question I had was concerning the the sheriffs and the deputy sheriffs, what powers does the deputy sheriffs have compared to the sheriffs?
Well, you know, I don't know if I'm the one to ask for that, but they are peace officers, and they have the same power of arrest that the sheriff does, but the sheriff controls them. You know, the sheriff is where the buck stops. So they're operating under the penal code and all that stuff. But a deputy sheriff is when a sheriff turns around and if he deputizes you, what power do you have? Well, you obviously got to have arrest powers if you see somebody doing something. You know, the sheriff sets the policy and procedure, though, you know, where the deputy
out here in Montana, we got some real problems with the sheriffs that arrested my brother-in-law. And nothing was following Constitution at all. I mean, he was supposed to be in front of a grand jury. He never saw a grand jury. He's doing a double 40-year sentence for some stupid crime that they didn't have one whit of evidence on. So you understand that I am heavy into this stuff, and I'm learning everything I can because I'm going to get that man out of there.
What state are you in? And he's in
Montana. He's in Deer Lodge State Prison.
Oh boy!
I mean they. And he's accused of molestation and non-consensual sex with his two stepdaughters, which now they're 21 or 22. But they brought this up, that this happened when they were, well, they said, first they said 8, then they said 10, then they said 12. They don't have, I mean, and then was a diary brought up according to the diary, they just said this. They're trying to help their mother in going through a divorce, and they just wanted to see what would happen. Well, what would happen was they arrested this poor guy who never did a rotten thing in his life. He was a Navy SEAL and saved all kinds of people's lives and things. And here he is now, 56 years old, serving 84 years. I mean, give me a break.
Wow. That's
so
terrible.
I've got some stuff to do with the judge and the prosecutor and the deputy sheriff, and I just need to have a lot of knowledge. I'm getting all I can.
Yeah, well,
thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot. Okay. Next caller, ended 6885. Name and state. You've been unmuted. Hello? 6885. Area code 661. Going once. Going twice. Okay, we're going to go to the next caller. Okay, Brian Sheehan. You've been unmuted.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, very good. How are you, Gerard?
Very good. Thank you.
That's Brian Sheehan here in New York City. I've been listening, I don't know, I guess about a year, but I never really had a chance to talk up. So I actually have a legitimate question on policy and procedure. I've been like a pro se litigant for a very long time, I guess over 20 years. I've won a number of suits, including custody of the kids, false arrest case, which resulted in my getting paid by the city of New York, et cetera, et cetera. Got one going now, which is pretty good, against some bad law firm out on Long Island. But I came across something that I didn't have an answer for, and that was what has prompted the call. I got a friend who was involved with the city, some nonsense about parking tickets. I don't know, he's going off the deep end, but it doesn't really matter. The point is that I told him that if he got involved with the NLA, he would find out how to handle the case, the procedure, et cetera. I think he wants to do that, but he's apprehensive, and one of the things he's apprehensive about is getting the case removed to federal court. Now, I know that you guys have a pretty good procedure on that, and have done it in the past. So I was checking with the clerk in Supreme Court, New York County, at 60 Center Street, and he told me that, yes, the papers have to have a seal on it. It was what I heard from my friend Joe. So I never heard that one before. So I went over to federal court. In fact, I was there this afternoon, over on Pearl Street, and I checked with the clerk there who said, yes, there's definitely a need for a seal. So obviously I don't have one. I was wondering if you guys had one that I could use get his papers.
I don't know why they're telling you need I have no idea why they're telling you you need a seal. I mean, look, okay. If people go to federal court, you file a paper, you put it in. Now, maybe the court stamps
it. I guess it's because it's a removal, because it was a state court action, which is now going to wind up in federal court. He wants to get it done right away. If I have to drive up a couple hundred dollars, up to you guys. It would be no problem. I could take care of that. But
yeah, I don't know that.
I need some guidance here.
I don't even know if it's something that we would do, because we don't usually do stuff like traffic cases. You know, we do like habeas corpus just to get people out of jail,
Right. No, he's not in jail. He's pursuing the city on some nonsense about the parking tickets. He's all worked up about it, but
Really not an area that we would get into, to tell you the truth. And I don't know why they're telling you need a seal. I don't know that much about that. It doesn't make sense. Anybody can have a seal. Every corporation has a seal. It's no big deal. You can go out and make your own seal. Go to Staples and make a seal. They want a seal, you got a seal. I don't know. Are they going to try to say you're simulating a court? That's what you got to watch out for. I don't know. I don't know. You know, when the clerk says it needs a seal, what's she talking about? From the lower court to the upper court?
Yeah, I think what that is referring to is the raised seal that you wind up with.
But what are they saying? You need the permission to bring it in. You see a lot of stuff that they do. We don't agree with a lot of stuff that is a corporate law. It's stuff that's not really constitutional, and it's policy and procedure. And you got to be careful. Right. If you understand, what the Constitution is and what they can do, and you also know, the rules of procedure for the federal as well as the state court, the CPLR, the federal rules of procedure. I don't know the federal rules of procedure as well as other people do that write, that help us with our federal papers. But, as far as what the seal is doing, we always, when we go in, we're going in as the grand jury, and we have a seal per that. And we don't ask permission because we're the tribunal, we're the people, right? So we seal our papers just like they do. And look at who has more power than the people do. That judge in there doesn't have more power than I do. I don't care what he thinks.
Right, of course not.
Because he's just a man, and he's not a king. And he's supposed to, he's supposed to be a magistrate there, just making sure justice goes through, So I don't know. I wouldn't give you advice on the seal. I would go and ask somebody higher up than that, or somebody that knows the federal rules of procedure.
You have sealed documents though in the past. You got yourself.
Well, we seal them as the grand jury. I never sealed my own. But like I said, even a corporation seals their own documents. Every corporation has a seal.
Do you know that
you write seal, S-E-A-L, next to a signature in a circle, and that's as good as stamping it. But I don't know what they're looking for. They're looking for a seal from the court.
That's why I want to call. And I did a 1983 case in the Eastern District.
Yeah, 1983 case. You go in, you put the case in, they take it from you. They, whatever they do, they time stamp it in, and then it goes. I think
When they started the docket sheet on that case, no one ever asked me for a seal. All of a sudden, I'm going to seal it.
Maybe the judge may seal a decision if you let the judge make a decision. If it's a jury trial and the jury makes a decision, I would think that the court clerk needs to seal the decision when it gets the judge's signature. And that's about that. Why would you need a seal coming in? I don't know. I would just go ask some more questions of that particular clerk. And, they're pretty good in the federal court. They seem to be friendlier to me. you know, filed papers in both. And it just seems like the federal courts are much nicer about helping the
person. Yeah, they are very helpful. They really are. In fact, in the Eastern District, there's actually a pro se court where there's a magistrate.
Because, you know, don't ask me. I don't want to get you in trouble. I don't get in trouble. I know just enough to be dangerous, you know.
I've been very successful at blowing them backwards. So.
Well, a lot of times just being there, you can blow. Look, if they trip over you, if nothing else, I win pool games by leaving too many balls on the table. How's that?
Yeah, exactly. I know. Well, if you guys need any papers shipped down there, let me know if you need me to run anything through. I've never signed up as to be an officer or anything like that, but I'm available. It's like I'm always around. I'm in title insurance.
We got stuff going on in Long Island. We got stuff that needs to go down there, so certainly you could help. No doubt about it. All right?
I'm always running around. Like I said, I was there this afternoon, and, you know, I'm always roaming in and out of these places. So if there were things that need to be recorded or filed, you know.
We got Maud down there. They're beating her up. She's in a rehab now. I have to get a hold of her. We got some cases down in Long Island in the city. But anyway, we appreciate it. I'm going to move to the next guy. Thank you. Thanks for all that.
All right, Gerard. Thanks very much. Keep up the good work. Talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks. Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. It looks like Michigan Charles, you are unmuted. I'm still
This is Paul, Michigan.
Oh, I don't know. That's what you came up at. We'll take Paul. How's it going, Paul?
I was waiting for Brent, but maybe you could help me. I got his book on Eklund's Common Law, and I also got his clause-by-clause book, and I'm thinking about buying the Bible that he put out. He speaks a lot about the term of first principles, and he covers it a little bit, but I was going to ask him to elaborate on that term a little more. Is it first principles versus second principles, or what? Do you know anything about that?
You know, who would know that would probably be John, because John read the book. I didn't.
Yeah.
So, I mean, John might be able to answer that better, and if not, Brent will be back next week and just put don't throw the question out. We'll give it to him. That's a good question.
He brings it up, so, you know, it must be important to him. And I just got some forward pages on that Bible that he did, and he brings it up in there too. So I wanted to elaborate on that if he could. So, you know.
Well, if I remember, I'll ask him too. If my brain works that long, I will bring it up, and if not, feel free to bring it up again, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Did we find Kelly out there yet? I can't tell you what phone she's on because she has three of them, and I don't know which one it is, and I don't want to give them all out.
I haven't found her by name.
No. She's got one phone is 5938, the ending. Just try this. Maybe you'll get one of them. The other one's 2943. Those are the two that you can look for. If she's not on either of them, then I don't know what to say. But
I'm on.
She's on. Where are you?
I'm here. Thanks, guys. Boy, it's been a long two hours and 20 minutes on this call, but a lot of really great information. I'm so glad that I was able to make it on here, even if you couldn't find me forever.
Believe me, it wasn't for lack of trying. I've been my eyes are going buggy. But anyway, it's good to hear from you.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm in the store now, so I'm just going to make this brief. If there's been a lot of information shared, I'm really excited about it. And whoever that gentleman that was the guest tonight, whoever he was, I know he's off now, but I would love to have thanked him for the information he gave. I have one question, but then also want to state I love Matthew Zeal and the information he brings, and he's not he's willing to challenge us, you know, like he did about, you know, the Islam and Muslim. I love that he brought that up. I also love that the other gentleman said differences have to be noticed, and with the Sharia law and things like that, those are very contrary to who we are as a people, and those differences will not be overlooked. I really hope we as a people can see that there are some differences that separate us to the point of us being unequally yoked together.
Right.
let's see. So my question is, as far as committees of safety go, because we're really here in Oregon, we're ready to get down and get to business. And we're ready for these indictments to come out. We're ready for, you know, sheriffs to come on board with us. And if they won't, we're ready for the people to start standing together. As far as forming a committee of safety in my own area, I am wondering how you guys feel about a woman being in the committees of safety. I keep hearing about the able-bodied men for militia. But if a man is not stepping up to do it in my county, can I get this thing going?
Absolutely.
Okay, great.
It's always the women that carry the men. You should know that by now. You're married with kids, are you not?
I'm
the biggest baby in the house. Are you kidding me?
I've learned over the years that we're only allowed to think we're in charge.
Well, that's what a good woman knows how to make you think you made the decision.
That's right.
Yeah.
I try.
Oh, it works better than you think it does. But anyway.
Okay, so that's a go. That can happen.
Yeah, let's
absolutely
look at. We're ready. I mean, now are you ready? That's where we're at. Those things are out there, and everybody needs to be ready because you gotta get these sheriffs to come in. I don't care if you get one or you get 40. They gotta come in. Whatever's there, gotta go.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's other things going on in this country besides this. I mean, it's you know, things coming to a head.
Right.
Well, I'll tell you, even talking about the militias and talking about the able-bodied men and the militias, women are just as much of value there too. I mean, there's many women I'll stand shoulder to shoulder with in any fight.
That's great. Well, that's
exciting. If you want to talk about shooting, you won't beat some of my daughters.
And then, so as far as the committees of safety, so you guys are fine with us just getting them going, right? We don't have to, you know, I'd like Matthew to get his going in Washington County. I'd like to get mine going in Clark County, which is...
Absolutely.
I don't think you need to overthink this. I come to the conclusion that it's pretty laissez-faire. The main thing is to get people together, get them talking. Look at how scared Grassy was because they had a committee of safety, because it's a meeting of townspeople that he doesn't control.
Right.
And that's what they're scared of.
Okay, so we do that, and, you know, where are we at with some of our indictments and moving forward, especially, you know, with the...
When that indictment goes in there, it's a quick process. It's bing, bing, boom. And, I mean, you can push it back a little bit, but not too far. You know what I mean? You can push them back because you have a notice of default, then you have a notice of contempt. You know, and there's two or three notices that can go out, and you can even throw another one in if you need to stall. But you can't stall. Look, once they go out, you better have a sheriff ready to go. You better be able to enforce the arrest. And I think we're pretty close, but you know what? It takes community support. And you're not going to go in there. You don't want to go in there without enough people, without enough support of the community. And that's the only thing that's holding us back. It's not the paperwork. The paperwork is good. It's ready to go. Are you guys ready? That's what I am. Is the sheriff ready? Are the people ready? You know, you don't want to start a war with only two bullets. Let's get a box full. Let's go. You know what I mean?
Okay.
People got to get together. Look, there's no sheriff's going to run up the hill with his sword out if nobody's behind him.
And that's where the community of safety is really a big boost. I mean,
got to have them. And the grand juries need them, too, because it gives everybody more credibility. When the committees of safety call the grand jury in, you know, that's the grand jury is not acting necessarily on its own, although they can. They definitely don't need a committee of safety to call them in. But when they come in on a committee of safety petition, that means they're addressing whatever problems that particular town in their committee of safety is having. And that's the other reason the militias need them, because it gives the militias credibility that they're actually, you know, called under duress or whatever. So they're not acting on their own. They're acting for actual townspeople.
For the people.
For the people, right.
So there's so many people I see that are really rearing to go, as we've been talking about all week, you know, and that are getting frustrated. And so I just want to assure them that, that work is happening, and to not go off on their own and draw their sword, but to know that, you know, the indictments are coming and that the people are rallying up together, and we will get these committees of safety launched. I love the dialogue that Matthew and that gentleman had about the different verbiage to use, because it is so easy to just go back to the First Amendment. You know, 2-3 months ago, I didn't even want to speak to Matthew about committees of safety because the term was so unusual to me. And now it's very common, but for people that it's not common, I love just saying, let's just carry out our First Amendment right and assemble together and talk. So I think that's great to apply that however people need to get the committees going.
Look, the people, the power's in the people, and the people have a right to assemble and as Brent was saying, associate and assemble. And
right.
Look, you can do a citizen's arrest, can't you?
Yeah.
Would you want to, though? Would you want to?
If you make me mad enough.
Well, you might. You're one of the few that maybe have enough courage. You know. Then what are you going to do? You got to bring them to the police station. But you get the idea. Look, you know, it makes life easier if we have elected law enforcement on our side. We know we're not wrong. We know we're right.
Right.
We can prove we're right. Our paperwork proves we're right. Can we stick an indictment in there and then just walk around the courts blowing our horns? Absolutely. Do we want to do it that way? It's not the way I prefer to do it. Will we have to do it that way? Well, maybe, yeah, maybe we have to. I don't know. Because this thing, look, we're rolling punches, you know what I'm saying? It's change.
Yeah.
Look, the people have to be prepared for whatever happens. I don't care what happens. They got to be ready to go. They got to be ready to support this thing.
So as far as meeting with the sheriff, you know, I'm in Clark County, Washington, and Clark County is pretty big and it's pretty liberal, and I've been seeing a lot of abuses from the police for quite a while that are pretty concerning. So when you guys say go and meet with your sheriff, for people out there like me, what would you counsel me? I mean, literally, I called Clark County Sheriff and asked him to have a meeting with me.
Well, let me tell you something. For a sheriff that's probably not sympathetic to this cause, probably has already been told that we're a bunch of terrorists or something to that effect. You know, we bandy about the militia word. They've been taught that that's a bad word,
right.
You know. So what I would do is I don't think you should go see your sheriff alone. I think what you need to do, if you had a committee of safety, you
right.
can go as a group. Look at your. I don't care how good or bad he is, but especially the bad ones. They're political animals, no matter what. They have to get elected, and they're sensitive to their constituents. So if they get 5 or 6 people that come in that are articulate, that they know they're kind of in a Tea Party group or a committee of safety, forget the Tea Parties, they've run their course. Let's call them committee of safeties now.
Mm-hmm.
People meeting and talking, they're going to be more sensitive to their constituents coming in. Sitting down with them, and not just one person, so he's not just fixated on you or targeting you, you know what I mean? Oh, there's
right.
that Kelly, you know what I mean? No, there's crazy Kelly and her 8 friends, and God only knows they're with her 160 committee of safety people. Gee, maybe I better listen to her. Okay?
Okay, so committee of safety first, and then the committee of safety should schedule appointments with
first.
The sheriff.
I'm just saying, if you know that you've got a sheriff that's not friendly, don't go in alone because you're just asking for trouble. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Go in with a group of people. And then, look, you go in friendly. But if he's really hard-nosed and he's not constitutional and he doesn't care and he's all for this jackbooted stuff, you say, that's very nice. We're going to be working to get you out of there, and we may even do a recall because you're breaking the law whether you know it or not.
Okay.
You can be tough with him like that. And you know what? He may respect you more if you like that, too.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's a good direction to go. One last question then, if I can remember what it was. Maybe I can remember what it was. Maybe I can't now. It was about the sheriff. Got it. Don't the indictments have to be carried out by the sheriff of that very county? And if so, how do we do that when word is our sheriff?
you know what, Kelly? This is extraordinary times, calling for extraordinary measures. Right now, this is the United States Grand Jury, the Unified United States Grand Jury. Okay. And that, the nice thing about Oregon is, guess what? You only have one federal district. And as far as I can see, look at that district is the same for all of your sheriffs. So it should be much easier to get them on board. And my goodness, if you could get a sheriff, Snaky Ward over there, if you could put him in the corner and say, look, sign the paper, invite the other sheriffs, and it's the last good thing you'll do. We'll have mercy on you, you know, when we're doing the indictments, you know. Sign it and let the other sheriffs come in. You know, he invited sheriffs from other counties in there when he was scared of the evil people up in the refuge there who weren't hurting anybody, right? He brought all of those sheriffs in. The sheriff has the ability to ask another sheriff into his county. But, you know, look, these guys, it's all the same federal district, and we're sending them all the same information. We're making crimes known to them. They have an oath to the Constitution. They have a duty to report it. They have a duty to arrest on it. You know what I mean? Because we're letting them know of a crime, and if they don't do it, then they're guilty of felony rescue. I mean, I hate to talk to them like that, but, you know, sometimes a little tough club comes in, you know. Look, they have a position. They either got to step up or step down. You know, it's called lead, follow, or get out of the way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's we're going to notice the sheriffs are all going to get a notice here about what's going on and what we're planning on doing and what we expect of them, we the people. Not necessarily we the grand jury, we the people. You know, we see them as the tribunal, but as the people. And nobody's more powerful than the people. You know, we created this government, and we certainly can fix it. God, my goodness, to believe that you got to ask the government's permission to fix the government. I never heard anything so ridiculous in all my life.
Right. That's pretty bad.
Yeah, it is. I mean, common law, common sense. There's no common sense in that.
So we are going to serve indictments then, even if the sheriff of that specific county is not on board. A different sheriff will serve that.
Look, there's marshals. The sheriff's not the only one who can do it, okay?
Okay.
There's other people that can do it. There's other elected officials. So, you know, I mean, God forbid we might get a governor on our side. You know what I mean?
Bruce Cuff.
There you go.
Bruce Cuffin in Oregon.
Look at the governor has police powers. You know, you got marshals. Forget about them. They're all over there trying to intimidate us from coming into the courts. You know, maybe there's a good one there. So, I mean, we're hoping, you know, to find. Look at when the people come out, you're going to find out how many of these officials that actually have the power to exercise will actually finally raise their head up. They're waiting to see the people.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
And so the people gotta amass, you know. I'm serious. You know, you guys go out and get a bunch of horns and start blowing them around the jail or something. You know what I mean? Let's relive the Battle of Jericho over here.
Yeah. You know? All right, we can do that.
Okay.
All right. Thanks,
very
George.
Good. Yeah.
Hey, bye, guys.
Thank you, Kelly. All right, I'm going to go to the next question here. Next question. It looks like, that was Kelly. Lynn? Hang on, let me hit this again. For some reason, I still have Kelly on there. Lynn Lombardozzi, is that it?
Hello.
Lynn?
Hello. Hello and good evening to you. I'm here. Can you all hear me?
I can. You're coming in good. What state are you from, Lynn?
I am in Pennsylvania.
Oh.
I am in what is part deemed to be the worst county in Pennsylvania, in Northampton County, one of the East Border Counties Home Rule Charter, one of our six counties with Home Rule Charter. I've been trying to get a habeas corpus. I've been listening in and a county organizer with NLA, I want to say, at least a year and a half. I have been arrested six times for non-payment of child support. However, no one ever listed us for custody, and my husband abandoned my children to me. I worked for Northampton County's Department of Human Services, and 19 years ago I helped to start a program against Clinton's adoption incentives when I worked for Department of Justice.
Oh, no wonder you're having trouble.
Well, my husband went unwell of mind and is medicating himself with alcohol. And my union chief with Department of Human Services was a Child Protective Service caseworker who was dual a coach in my boys' youth football league, hence the CPS caseworker, knew us in the community and hanging out with my husband. My husband does not understand what is going on, and they are using my husband, who's giving them all kinds of trash on me in retaliation because he's not well and he doesn't get it. And the district attorney, now of Northampton County, is running for Pennsylvania's attorney general, and the district attorney doesn't like the information that I have. I am fully alone. I cannot get anyone else summoned up to help me. I paid off a house, almost paid off, would have been paid off August last year. In July, four sheriff deputies came to my house without papers, surveilled my house for 3 hours, my neighbors told me, to the point where 10 minutes prior, I removed all of my clothes to get in the shower, so clearly these sheriff deputies would have had to have seen me without my clothes in the house, is when they drilled through my deadbolt into the house with no papers. I was arrested and held in jail for 5 days. I am homeless, living in my truck, and I am running for my life.
What were they coming to your house for? What were they claiming that they had the authority to drill into your door? What was it?
They had no papers. I asked them for their papers. And when I heard the vibration in the walls as I was getting into the shower, so I went back out to the hallway, and then I heard the actual drill. So I looked out the window, and they were outside with my husband, who tried to kill me 10 years ago. So they took him to jail and rushed me to the hospital. But the district attorney has covered up everything my husband did and gave him ARD for an attempt on my life, violating Pennsylvania's 234 criminal laws. The victim must approve ARD. I didn't know what was going on until years later when I went into the NCDVU, the domestic violence unit, after my husband threatened to kill my son. They are heavily aiding my husband. I am running for my life and living in my truck for the last 8 months. The cops can come up at any point as I'm asleep during the night to my truck. I am completely vulnerable.
Well,
no one will help me.
I don't know where to tell you to go with that. I mean, they have organizations that help women to get away from their abusive husbands, and they won't tell anybody where you go. I would check with them. In the meantime,
I can't find any of them. I am with Crime Victims Council, who is in part trying to help, but they tell you.
Is there something holding you in Pennsylvania there where you're at? I mean, can you leave there for now, temporarily?
I don't know. I can't find anyone to help me with where to go to. And what it is at this point.
You're on a nationwide call right now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of people that are listening. And there's lots of groups out there. Don't say you can't, because you can. There are groups. And
please do not. Please do not, because I have gone and gone and gone and called and called and called. Now, Crime Victims Council is my current department, and please help me.
Right.
I've gone through NLA to help me get a habeas corpus. They removed my computers. I have no computer. I am living in my house. They took my job from me, removing also my regular medical insurance. Now they're part tracking me through the Medicaid.
Listen,
it's horrible.
I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to give you a number to call. I'm going to have you call Linda, and you talk to her about doing an affidavit. I don't know what process you've been through yet with us, if you've done any. But it's very, very important to get your affidavit, and no matter what you're going to do.
When you say Linda, you are talking about Linda Palmer.
Right.
I have spoken with Linda Palmer. No one is helping me to get my affidavit done.
So you can't, you're not, I'm sure she gave you directions. You can't do it. You don't have a computer. What's the matter?
I cannot do it myself.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll have to figure something else out then. I don't know.
I'm not getting any responses for help.
Well, all I can tell you is I will talk to Linda and see what the problems are, and I'm sure she has your contact information, right?
And is there any way I can have your contact information?
Well, you could get me here on the email, Gerard@NationalLibertyAlliance.org. Gerard at NationalLibertyAlliance.org.
Gerard.
Correct, right. And then just shoot me an email, and then I'll answer you back. And we'll see if we can find, I mean, obviously you need somebody to sit with you. I don't know who's there. Or what part of Pennsylvania? And you said the eastern part. Are you
eastern border.
Yeah, so a lot of people work in New York City that live there, right? They commute. It's close to New York City, right?
There's a lot of commuting in from New York City to the Lehigh Valley.
I don't know. Let me see if we can find somebody that's close enough that knows what they're doing that can help you. I mean, I don't know what else to tell you. You know, you need somebody to sit with you. I don't know. We'll have to see if we can find somebody. You know? That's the best I can do. I don't know what, I mean, my heart bleeds for you, but I don't know what else, you know. The thing is you got to sit down and get things fleshed out. So I'll get a hold of me. I'll talk to Linda. I'll see what we can do. I'm not promising you great results right away, but if we get somebody to sit with you, that's a big, big start for you.
What happened is, you need to hear this, when they broke into my house, I didn't know that they were coming. They came in part to sabotage me. They stole a large part of my records, and I can't go to the courthouse and get them. I have had attorneys.
Don't worry about that. Look, that'll all work out. Listen, don't stress over that stuff. That's all you need is your story. That's all. You don't look at the record we can get. Don't worry about that. You know, look, let's not sweat the small stuff. And
I need someone to help me to complete that affidavit.
That's the big stuff. You need somebody to sit with you, and I'll see what I can do, okay?
And I can come. I'm willing, like we said. I am homeless living in my truck. I'm willing to get on a bus and come to someone.
Right. So we need to talk about that. We need to see. Look, you need to get to a place where you can, like, be safe.
And that's what I told Linda Palmer. I'm willing to come somewhere because I have no home. I have no lease. They've put me out of my home that I was paying off the next month. They gave my husband, attorney in fact, to sign my name off the house. They used it to pay his lawyer.
Yeah, well, that's this evil system we're battling. So look.
Well, they trafficked me as hostage in the home to pay off the mortgage years after he left. And then when they knew it was going to be paid off into other things coming up, then they broke into my home. And everyone on the street thinks I have to be a pedophile, drug addict, some kind of nutcase, or the sheriffs wouldn't have done that because our community, our society is not educated.
No, well, they'll take that until they run afoul of the law. Everybody runs afoul of the law sooner or later. If it's not them, it's their kids or somebody they love. Look, at this snake. This snake is eating its tail, rest assured. I'm gonna go ahead and switch now, but somebody...
I will email.
Huh? Yes.
I will email.
Yes, email me, and let me see who we can find out there, okay?
Okay, thank you so much, Gerard.
Yeah, take it.
And thank you.
Bless you.
Thank you to all the speakers tonight. You guys were awesome. It's just I'm here alone praying day in, day out.
Well, now you got the whole group praying for you. There you go. See? You'll see things will change now for the better, okay?
Six times they have jailed me, thrown me in suicide and all.
Yeah. Well, listen, we could change it. Anyway.
Okay.
Have a good night.
Thank you all.
Yeah. Jim, New York. Bet you didn't think we'd ever get to you, Jim, did you? You there? Or did you fall asleep already? Jim, New York. Hello, Jim. It says you're unmuted. Wait a minute. Let me try this one more time. How about now, Jim, New York? I don't know. All right. Try to get back in there, Jim. Okay, Rhonda, Washington. Rhonda from Washington. I guess I'm still on. I don't hear anything. I don't hear Rhonda. Okay, Jim just got back in. Let me get to the next question here. Try it. Wireless caller.
Hello, Mike Jerome from Colorado 719 area code. How are you this evening?
Hey, good. How's it going?
Good. I forwarded some info on my grandkids, the case, and the probate case, 2009 PR7. I was wondering if anybody has received and seen it.
I don't know myself. I'd have to check with the intake. But you know what? There's a track. There's a way to track what you put in there. Do you know how to go on there and track your case?
I do with the U.S. Postal Service 1-800 number and the check.
No. I mean, if you wait a minute. You sent us paperwork, National Liberty Alliance. You sent paperwork.
Correct.
In?
Correct.
To us? I mean, do you filled out an intake form, or what did you do?
Yes, I did an intake form and a complaint and documentation from the courts that are showing unconstitutional and violation of due process towards me.
Right. So what are you looking for, like a habeas corpus to release from the court or what?
No, I did a habeas corpus for my daughter. I'm pending on the results on that. This other one was a CPS intake for my grandchildren. And the other one was an intake for a probate case still pending on the district court here in Colorado, Cornell.
Right.
After 7 years of my mother's death.
Right. Hey, what's your name? What's your first name?
My name's Michael.
Michael?
Kiron, J-I-R-O-N.
K-I-R-O-N, okay. I know that we kind of stopped on those cases while we were doing this stuff in Oregon, so your case is probably in there, but we'll check and see where you are and where your paperwork is. You got to, you know, Linda started doing some of those cases, but you got to finish what's necessary to go through there, you know, to put you up in the front of the line once we start doing them again, you know? The people that get their paperwork done first will be first. And I just got an email from her. She says she has your case and she's going to work on it this week. So give her a call, you know, the beginning of next week and see where she's at with it, okay?
Correct.
You got through to okay.
Correct. That's one of the cases. That's a case for my daughter being in the Colorado Department of Corrections, unlawful sentence. I have three of them cases. My grandchildren taken away unlawfully in 2008 and the probate case. But I'll give her a call and see if she knows about those other two cases. Thank you very much.
Yeah, give her a call. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Good luck to you. God bless you. Okay.
Hello, Jim.
How you doing, Jim?
Yeah, I had my phone muted before. I can't believe I didn't believe that.
I don't feel so bad now. You don't know how many times I talk to myself. So, what's up? I heard you took on a little bit of work, huh?
Oh, yeah, pretty busy up here. I wanted to elaborate on the seal issue from 15 minutes ago.
Oh, thank you very much. Go ahead.
I do believe Bill Thornton said that all you have to do is write the word seal.
Yeah, I told them that. I don't know why they want a seal. I mean, look it. If
no,
you
give
were,
them a seal. If they want one, give them one. What's
yeah,
the difference?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. You just look it. You got to be careful in this day and age. You don't know what they're doing. But, you know, like you said, Bill says just put the word seal and that's the seal. But I don't think that's what they really want. I think they're looking for some kind of a paper from the lower court, which, look, we don't do that stuff with them. We don't play that game where you ask permission to do what you, you know, they abuse you and they go, okay, you got to ask permission before you can, like, make a stop, you know? So I don't know, you know, like, if you're going to sue the government, they want you to get permission. You're supposed to notify the attorney general. Because I don't think any of them carry bonds. I think the controller covers them today. I don't know what kind of stuff they're doing, you know, as far as their oaths and bonds and stuff. But I know that, like, they expect you to ask permission to sue the state. And we try not to sue the state. We try to sue them in their personal capacities for, you know, for violating us under color of law. And they think they're immune, but they're not. Because if you can prove that they're operating under color of law, then they're not immune. So I don't know what they wanted. I think he needs to really clarify what they're asking him. But you're right. You can write seal if they want a seal. Like you said, you don't argue. What Thornton says, give them what they want, right? He says, don't argue with them. If they want to change the heading, change the heading, right?
Exactly so.
Yeah. It's a good lesson, I guess, you know.
Yeah, so we're going to hold a little freedom fair out here in our little small town in a bunch of speakers, and it's a good way to promote the Committee of Safety is that little get-togethers like that. We hope to have hopefully 1,000 people, but we'll see.
Wow, that's not a little one. That's big. You're out towards Middleburg, right?
Yeah, and apparently, you know, the word is out, and we're the first thing to come out in the spring, you know, so we're bound to get a good turnout.
Well, that's good. Maybe I'll take a ride up. When's it going to be?
May 7th.
That's a weekend?
Yeah, it's a Saturday. It's the day before Mother's Day.
Oh, okay. So I'll see if I can make it out there.
I wish you would. I was mentioning to Carl that we're going to have it and trying to get some of the local county organizers to see if they can come over and maybe we'll put a table up.
Let's get New York back off the ground again. We've kind of neglected it, you know what I mean? We started out here first and ran off everywhere else, and now New York is like it's suffering, you know? We've got to clean our own backyard up over here, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. This train moves slow, but we're still moving it.
Well, the one thing is moving in the right direction, and it moves a little bit each day, and it's the tortoise and the hare, and it look and you know, the writing's on the wall now. When you hear all the baloney and all the noise, that's when you know you're doing a good job. When everybody's clamoring to climb on board or ruin you, you know you're doing a good thing, right?
Yeah, it's hard to have this patience, though. It's a virtue.
I know.
We're only here for so long. I want to see an end to this.
I know. I pray every day for patience. You know? I just don't put me in the don't throw me in the briar patch, so to speak. You know. But you're
all right.
Right.
I'll let you go.
Yep. We're very close, so let's keep going. And that thing you're doing, that's a good idea. That's grassroots. That's how you start it. You know, get people together. Thanks, Jim.
All right, God bless.
God bless you, too. Okay, Curtis from Virginia, do you hear me?
Yes, sir. I'm here waiting patiently. I was glad to hear my name mentioned there. Thank you. But there was a gentleman last week that was asking about Indian affairs, and I had mentioned the Avalon Project on the Yale University website, I believe it was.
Okay.
You can find out about those treaties there. But also, I wanted to check it out, but I think USC Title 25 under Indian Affairs, it just says Indian on the title now because they're changing everything. And I had mentioned on our Tuesday IRC call that every about every 4 to 6 months I check on the Virginia code to check on some of the things like that 1-308 where federal citizens, you know, can reserve their right, where they like to put it.
Yeah.
And that's the item that they've changed three times. Once it originally was put in 107 and went to 207 and then went to 308. Well, it's been there for the last couple of years, but I went to check on it last week, and it was all gone. The whole website's been changed on Virginia Code. In fact, not only did I find that missing, completely missing, but usually statute 1-305 was how it's to be applied, and 308 was how you apply it. Right? And you put your, you know, you can put reservation rights. You know, and a whole assortment of other things, anything will do. But that was all completely gone, absent from that section.
Well, you know what that means, don't you?
Yeah, well, while I was looking for that to see where they might have moved it, I haven't chanced on down lower in that section, and it said the quo warranto common law had been abolished, and quo warranto statutory had been established. And the only thing I got out of that whole thing was 1977. Wow. That's all I can say. How do you abolish common law?
I don't know.
Especially a quo warranto. That's where you question the government's where the authority is. How
well,
do you do
you
that?
Want to abolish it, you know. Who's writing that? The ones breaking the laws, right? Doesn't mean anything.
Absolutely. I'm like, well, you know, that doesn't mean anything.
Now it doesn't. They come up with these stupid rulings, and they think that, you know, because it's in writing and it's in black and white, somehow that makes it okay.
Yeah, well, they just do it. They're all getting just like Obama. You know, if Congress don't do it, then I'm going to do it myself. I'm just gonna make it up as I go along, and we're gonna just assume that that is not law, but it don't work that way. And I noticed some other things while I was going through. I was looking, trying to cover issues on the grand jury and the coroner. And in the old jurisprudence book, which are dated back in the 60s, which do make reference to second edition, I don't know how that all works. I'm still trying to figure that out. But I found two sections where the grand jury is mentioned. In one section, volume 7. It was under homicide. I was checking on coroners, you know, and their authority to, you know, the authority of the sheriff, which is identical to the sheriff's ability, you know, to call a grand jury to present it,
right,
to do an indictment and so forth, you know, and that's all exactly right on. I was really surprised it was in there. And while I was digging into that, I found a section on there on grand jury, and it went into great detail on their authority, the secrecy, you know, all of those things that we've been learning, you know, of course, here on the website. But the writers that I noticed that the writers that were supplying that information weren't my attorneys. And then, in fact, it said that the difficulty and the distortion about the rights of the common law and the people to run the common law grand jury are coming. It point blank comes out and says, These discretions are coming about because of the bar attorneys, the bar association, and the bar committee. It says it right in the jurisprudence book. I was blown when I ran across that.
Yeah, right.
But I wanted to complete this thought.
Yeah.
Now, I ran across here recently. I started looking under, because you can't find it when you're looking at the grand juries. I found it under, you know, under criminal trials and stuff. So I found under Book 13 a section in here that had to do with larceny, and it had to do with defending minor felony cases. And it had a section in there also about the grand jury. And the person that wrote that just happened to be, unfortunately for us, he was a bar member. And, of course, he calls the grand jury, and, of course, the description in this particular section, it's not common law like the other one was. I could determine that that was a common law description of a grand jury. But here, this is not a common law description of a grand jury. It's a statutory description of a grand jury.
Uh-huh.
And he calls this thing a Star Chamber throwback.
A Star Chamber throwback, huh?
Yeah, well, actually, I got it right here. Let me read it to you exactly what it says. Now, this is coming from a bar attorney.
Right.
He's writing it. He says, the grand jury, although a vestigial remnant of Star Chamber proceedings, is actually built-in safeguard for the defendant. But, you know, I noticed that all the references to it are referring to grand juries from 23 down to 16, not the 25 that is common law.
Yeah, that's, you know what? That's what, you got a point there. Yeah.
And this, these are the things that I've identified. Two locations in the same book volumes that give you two descriptions from two different attorneys or two different writers. One was a bar background. One was not a bar background. One's giving you a description of a common law grand jury, and another one's giving you a statutory description of a grand jury.
Well, you know, all you need is a lawyer to fix things. You know, 16.
I can't wait to get one.
Look, at 16 might be a quorum for a grand jury. In other words, if they had people not show up, they could probably still move ahead with 16. But you see, what they do is, somebody says, okay, 16's a quorum. Next thing you know, they're only picking 16. That's how
you don't have to
pick 16. You know, you just whittle it away, you know.
Well, that's exactly what you just mentioned is what it brings out later on as he's going through his little pitch here. He doesn't go into great detail on anything. But I found it really kind of insulting that it looks like they do everything they possibly can to avoid giving you a description of what a real common law jury does. But they don't mind giving you everything they can as to statutory meaning.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that has become so prevalent, you know, in my reading. So,
you know what I was going to tell you before? When John was doing research in New York on grand juries, there was a period where they really started attacking the grand jury heavy early on. And there was, early on. I'm talking about like 1930,
mm-hmm.
1940, they were really knocking them down pretty bad. And there was a group in New York that came out. And by the time they got done, the grand jury exited stronger than when these idiots tried to take it out. They went and put language in there that still survives to this day in the New York Constitution and in the laws. And it says it will never be abrogated. It would never be dissolved. And I'm sure that was from the effort of those guys that came in here trying to ruin that, because it's a cornerstone of our freedom. It really is.
Well, when you go to Article 6, too, how do you not understand that the Bill of Rights is something they have no control over? Who are they to tell us, I'm talking about Virginia, to say that they can just come out and eliminate a common law procedure? Now, in Black's Law, 4th edition, the definition of a writ is very plain. I got it right off the bat. It is a common law procedure. So if common law and a writ is a process by which that we have a right to exercise, who in the hell has the right statutorily, who is being delegated authority, can they ever at any time say that we can't do something that we have by law natural right to you?
Absolutely not. Look, it's ridiculous.
In our process.
Look, our forefathers didn't leave us a provision to legislate away the Constitution. And these people, they go in and because the legislators pass it, they act like it's law. It's not law. It's Marbury versus Madison said if it's repulsive to the Constitution, it's null and void on its face from the beginning.
Absolutely. That's the way I perceived it. That's the way I perceived it. And even when you look in the same, this same particular book, I'll give you an example. One of the trickeries, you know, the use of their definitions of words. I know that the definition of a person is under Title I, which is constitutional construction. the constitutional construction and the construction of the statute has to accept a definition of a person as a live birth, born, heart beating, blood pumping being that had a mother and was given birth. That's Article 1, Section 8. So any other person that's described anywhere else is only reference to that title, and this is where they want to play games like out of George Orwell's 1984. They want to change the definitions and the meaning of the word so that it means whatever they want it to mean, when they want it to mean it, and you don't know what the word means. It's just like Scalia said, words have meaning, but not to them.
Right.
It has whatever they mean it to mean. What is it? What in the heck is that? When I'm reading the title, when I'm reading a section on here on defense of your income tax, and the only word that's constantly rampant through this thing is taxpayer. And all I can think of, you know, in reference, I'm just using this in an open brand, not referring to anything in specific, just for the information and the interest of conversation here. A taxpayer, if I don't identify myself as a taxpayer, then that whole block of law doesn't mean anything to me.
Absolutely.
It's having to do with taxpayers. What if I don't consider myself a taxpayer?
Well,
that's
where you got to know how to rebut it. And look, we're at midnight. I want to stop the tape so it doesn't go too long. And I appreciate all your input there. And we'll do it again next week.
Man.
Good stuff. Thanks, Kurt.
All right, brother. We'll talk to you later. I just wanted to throw that in.
Okay. Bye.